All right, good afternoon, everybody. Call the meeting to order. Please join me for the Pledge of Allegiance. Thank you. We do have a quorum. Director Rice informed me that she was running into traffic on her way down from Half Moon Bay, where she attended the Coastal Commission meetings both yesterday and early this morning. So she should be here shortly. Report from closed session, Mr. Carmel.
Thank you, President Pearson. The board discussed labor negotiations and provided instructions to its labor negotiators, but there's nothing to report.
Okay, thank you. Agenda review, any additions or deletions? Anybody want to swap anything around? No? We're good? Okay. All right. And we're moving right along here. Mr. Beneffin, are you ready? We will have the report from the PROS Commission Chairman. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. Steve Niffen, Chairman of the PROS. Just a couple of things that we're still dealing with. The skate park across the street, they've torn the rest of it out. Carlos is pretty sure that it's the wood has got to be taken away, and they're going to – so the plan – as long as you're okay with it, is going to be that they're slowly going to add concrete elements to that park over time with a little bit of money that we get every year with the PROS money, whatever that may be. But the idea is we have to move away from wood because every 5 to 7 years we're going to have a cost associated with that that's beyond our ability to deal with. So, but once again, putting the word out that if you want to be involved with that, we're still, you know, it's going to be a long-term planning thing as we begin to implement those different elements over there. But we are going to keep that particular item over there. So that was one thing. The other thing is next month in December, we're having our meeting at the water yard because we're going to walk the parking lot and the dog park area and try to really get a spot where we want to put the restrooms and then make sure so we can give that spot to the engineers and the whatnot to make sure that that's okay, that that goes there. And then other than that, we've got the PROS vacancies that we're dealing with first on the agenda. So other than that, I just have take questions if you had any.
Okay, great. Anyone have any questions, comments on PROS? Oh, you're getting off easy this time.
Yeah, uneventful. Right on. Thank you.
Uneventful. All right. This is going swimmingly well so far. Next is public comment. I have two requests for public comment. The first is from Mr. Mark Ober, and the second, Christine Heinrichs. Mr. Ober.
Thank you so much. I'm a resident here. I gave some notes to the district clerk just in case I don't speak quickly enough. I didn't realize that the fire. I'll do my best. How's that? I'm not used to this. Sorry. I guess the chief is going to give some points on fire issues here, so hopefully this is some edification. I've spoken with him regarding some of the concerns and given him my list too. So. The primary point is that we have CAL FIRE split responsible for housing and Cambria Fire responsible for vacant lots, and they're not working together. CAL FIRE, when they had it in their entirety, as you well know, showed up all the time. They're now quite invisible. I went down to slow CAL FIRE and talked with the big chief down there who's since quit in June. His name was Greg, and he said that there is no enforcement because the cost of enforcement is more than the legal cost. And to me, that's not sustainable. If you have a law or you have rules, if they're broken, it has to be enforced, even at a cost. My primary thing is to say we need to combine them one way or another. I know there are conversations. It needs to be completed. I think whether it's delegated half to Cal Fire or half to Cambria Fire, you still need some entity primarily responsible for the managing the property and making reports and filing breach or problematics. Primarily, the issues at hand would be is vegetation. And I went back to my own little code that I had to do, and things like pampas grass and things like bamboo and all of these extremely fire-causing plants, I have to personally remove, but because Cal Fire is responsible for it, there's nothing done. So it would be my recommendation that that responsibility for monitoring remain within the community. That might incur a cost. On the other hand, maybe as fire people meandered around town, as even water district people, if you observe something that's in non-compliance, there's a reporting methodology, and we can solve it. I don't really want my house to burn down or somebody else's house burned down because Fred down the street is doing something improperly. I'd refer you to UWIC 603. Those are policies that should be enforced. Freestanding structures, which I actually saw in the presentation today, there are enforcements requirement upon that in terms of it. The two areas of landscape are within even the water problem we have here where we're trying to conserve water. We say you cannot plant something that is not local and or doesn't take a lot of water. But in some of those cases, those are actually cause more fire than not. So again, that should be a singular policy. I referred the fire chief to marincounty.org. You can take a look at their fire safe thing. It's a really excellent thing. They took it, take a look, and it's on the paper that I gave in to y'all. That's a really good website to view it on, and they've gone through plants upon this, and Marin is certainly safer area and environment than we are. I think there should be a feedback mechanism from Slow Building and Safety to you all for any new permit, or let's open our eyes to people who are not utilizing permits so that you can monitor that sort of construction. My house was designated when it was built as a structure located in a high Cal Fire wildland severity zone and a high CCSD fire, and I'm not even in the forest. So when roofs are put on that are not Fire A, and I was required Fire A, you're putting the entire community at risk. And roofing companies have specific rules in the state of California. So I guess I'll summarize it's written, but we need a policy that is uniform, and we need inspections from the community, or Cal Fire has to be made responsible through the board to doing their job. Thank you much.
Thank you. Christine Heinrichs.
Good afternoon. Yesterday at the Coastal Commission, two building permits from the county were appealed. They were on the commission's agenda for the meeting currently in progress, although one has been postponed at the request of the applicant. The documents submitted include two letters approving use of the grandfathered water meter and attesting to the water offsets of the retrofit program from Melissa Bland. This is a questionable use of a staff member to handle controversial matters. These water meter, retrofit, you name it, water sleight of hand projects should come before the board. It is not appropriate to handle them administratively without giving them the public light of day. The Coastal Commission has been clear in its recommendation of denial of the People's Self-Help Housing Building permit, and again in the Swift permit and the Hadian permit, that no new water users can be allowed in Cambria. In the case of Swift and Hadian, two commissioners have stepped in to appeal these permits because of the seriousness of the situation. This is not a grandfathered project. as the Coastal Commission makes clear, quote, there were originally a limited number of these grandfathered pipeline projects, but there are no more such pipeline projects pending today. The retrofit program is, in plain words, fraudulent. The Commission's staff report is kinder. Quote, the CCSD's program does not appear to actually offset such water use, even if it were to be deemed an appropriate tool to meet LCP standards, which it is not. The claim that Cambria does not issue building permits is an evasion. The county rubber stamps Cambria's approval of these projects. They object to that characterization, preferring to call themselves a pass-through agency. Regardless, the commission also takes the county to task for failing to make its own determination that Cambria has adequate water to serve new users, as it is required to do under the local coastal plan. Please see the staff report. May I bring this up to you at the end? The summary of which I have here to give to you, because it would take more than 3 minutes to read. I strongly urge all members of the board to read all three of these staff reports and reflect on whether it is worthwhile to continue to waste the Coastal Commission's time on building permits that violate the local coastal plan and threaten Cambria's water supply. Allowing a staff member authority to give permits a green light is inappropriate. Please stop wasting the public's and the commission's time on similar applications. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I've read these. Welcome, Director Rice. Glad you traveled safely. We have two more requests for public comment. We'll have Ms. Bettenhausen first and Ms. Dickinson second.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I hope that you've all been attending to the Poet Laureate of the United States this year, Joy Harjo, a Navajo woman and an exquisitely excellent poet. I forgot to bring her book, so I went to the library just now. I was going to read a poem of hers, and I checked out the book by Ivan Brown Otter. He's also a Navajo poet, and I'd like to read one of his poems for you today. Navajos don't own land, paren. They belong to the land, and paren. Grandfather, my Indian blood has slept too long. I awaken to drums of the earth, and walk where spirits once walked that land. Sweep my hand into the past, breathe sage and sky, soar with the red tail on twisting plumes of creosote air. Enter mountains through solid rock and feel earth is alive. Slow motion sunrise, clear water, wind, peninsula mesa, holds basin of sky. Rocks glow in sweat lodge, sweet grass smoke drifts, sage sparks crackle darkness like stars. Grandfather, my Indian blood flows with the heartbeat of drums. I am this place where I stand.
Thank you. Ms. Dickinson.
Good afternoon, Board. Thank you, President Pearson. Tina Dickinson. To follow up on Mr. Mark Ober's comments at the beginning of public comment, I have for years had issues with people who have been and are irresponsible in maintaining their properties. I've been to NCAC and brought it up. I have taken photographs. I've submitted it, and I've talked to Bruce Gibson about it, but it's really difficult sometimes because of the layout of our unincorporated area. We don't have many stop signs, and so one has to be incredibly careful. But what I'm having real issues with is like trying to make a right turn somewhere, and you can't see because there's so much overgrowth. We have this issue that threatens us of living in a forest and fire. And yet, we talk about fire. We have the fire focus group. We have so much emphasis on fire, and yet so little is done to physically address the problem. And I don't know how many more times I can bring it up. This gentleman brought it up, but what can the CCSD do and or the fire department? I've talked to Chief Hollingsworth. He tells me I need to talk to CAL FIRE. Who do we go to, and how can we address a potentially, it is very dangerous. One is fire, but the other is you simply can't see to get around a corner carefully and maybe, you know, to avoid, trying to avoid an accident. So that's one. And then the second is that I did watch a portion of the Coastal Commission meeting yesterday and today on a different issue, but the issues yesterday were, of course, on 32D&E on their agenda regarding the two properties to be developed in Cambria that were one, they both were denied, but the one applicant was unable to be there. So it just speaks volumes as to where this district has gone or tried to go and is still in the midst of a gigantic mess. And I have to, you know, it is so frustrating to Cambrians, for the, doesn't matter who's on the board, which board, the staff has remained for them, has changed, but we still have Mr. Carmel and the administrator, Ms. Madrid, so there is some continuity there. But where are we going? Where's Mr. Ogren? We'd like to hear about the CDP process. I don't know if that's going to be addressed today or not, but it is becoming more and more frustrating to we Cambrians or us Cambrians who are paying a lot of money for something that we're seeing no results for. So it's really frustrating, and my time is up. So I thank you for listening, but it is a huge frustration for all of us. You know much more than we do. I wish you'd share more. Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome back, Ms. Dickinson. All right. End of public comment. I would like to speak to one thing. Mr. Ober, if you are passionate about this, we do have a fire safe focus group here in town that you'd be glad to. Okay, good. Our next meeting is in January on the second Wednesday of the month at 3:00 in the afternoon, and it'll be at the firehouse, I hope. Great. And we are at that committee looking at trying to get the Cambria Fire Department to be in charge of both unimproved and improved lots. Okay, so we're moving in that direction. It's just going to take us some time. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
President Pearson?
Yes.
On the intersection issue, the folks to contact would be Public Works, specifically the Roads Department. So because they will come out and talk to property owners. In the past, they used to. I don't know if maybe they don't anymore. And the other thing is thank you very much to Dr. Bettenhausen for the nice poetry, and I like your new hat.
All right, we move on to regular business. Item number 4A, Mr. Weigold.
Yes, Mr. President. Staff's recommending for 4-alpha that the Board of Directors adopt Resolution 41-2019, reappointing Steve Niffen, Adolf Atencio, and Joyce Renshaw to the Parks, Recreation, Open Space Commission. Both Niffen and Tencio's terms expire at the end of this year, and Joyce Renshaw, who had resigned in July, would like to be considered for another term.
Okay, very good. Discussion, comments? We have all of those people here. I'd like you all three to stand up and be recognized, and thank you very much for volunteering to continue to serve on the commission. Well, I don't know that we could possibly deny such passion for helping us out with the parks and recreation area. So anyone have a motion or other comments? Vice President Farmer.
Well, first, I want to commend the three folks before us, as well as the other two members of the PROS Commission, the PROS Board, PROS Committee, for doing such, for being passionate about the needs of this community, and the fact that, especially Ms. Renshaw, after what she's been through in recent months, wishing to return with even more passion in serving on the PROS Committee. And this committee is just another indication of the volunteerism in this community to do the best they can for this special place. So I just want to thank all of you, especially the fact that they have the most eccentric committee president, which always livens things up no matter where he is. So thank you so much.
Director Rice.
I worked with Joyce Renshaw on the North Coast Advisory Council, and she's the one I've worked with the most. And I specifically am very glad to see you're back. But we couldn't do it without the chair, Steve Niffen, who's done a great job with nice, brief reports from the committee so that we know what's going on a continuing basis. And I'm looking forward to getting to know and working with Adolf more, because I haven't had a chance to work with you much. So thank you. I would like to move that we adopt Resolution 41-2019, reappointing Steve Niffen, Adolf Atencio, and Joyce Renshaw to the Parks, Recreation, and Open Space Commission.
I'll second that.
Thank you. Okay. We have a motion and a second, so can we have a roll call vote, please?
Director Rice?
Aye.
Vice President Farmer?
Aye.
Director Steidel?
Aye.
Director Howe?
Aye.
President Pearson?
Aye. All right, very good. Moving along, we are now on number 4B. Mr. Weigel.
On 4B, staff's recommending adopting Resolution 39-212019, introducing Ordinance 02-2019 by title only and waiving the full reading. Number three, scheduling a public hearing for December 19th, 2019, regular board meeting to consider adoption of Ordinance 02-2019. And four, directing the CSD staff to submit Resolution 39-2019, Ordinance 02-2019, and all appropriate and required documentation to the County of San Luis Obispo as required by the California Health and Safety Code, Section 13869-.7. Chief Hollingsworth will be making a presentation.
Very good. Chief, before you get started, Crosby Schwartz would like to make a public comment on this one, which you can probably help him out answering. So,
good afternoon, President Pearson, members of the board and staff. I have a question about some of these road and driveway requirements. There's several of them, but one in particular serves as an example. It's on page 24 of the agenda package, CFC section 503.2.7 grade. It says the grade for all roads, streets, private lands, and driveways shall not exceed 16%. What is the district's responsibility if all the roads, streets, private lands and driveways exceed 16%. I don't think that's something that the district actually can control completely. So then that would apply to these other, the turning radius, turnarounds, turnouts, all of these road-related things. So,
thank you. Okay, thank you. Chief Hollingsworth.
Thank you for letting me be here today and present this for you. And Crosby, I think I'll hopefully be able to answer your questions for you here in the presentation. Before we get going, I'll kind of go through this quickly. There's a lot of technical data here, but I don't want to bore you with that. But I do want to say thank you to a couple of people just because of how this is not an easy process. This is a lengthy endeavor to go through, and I couldn't do it with a lot of extra help. So first of all, I'd like to thank our GM, Mr. Weigold, for being able to review this and offer insight in the process, because this is not a one-person operation by any means. I want to thank Haley Dotson for the amount of coordination she provides. As you can see, there's a lot of documentation here. There's a lot of documentation on the back end of this that ends up going to the county, and she's been very seminal in being able to help coordinate that. So a big thank you to her. And then ultimately to legal counsel. I cannot do this process on my own. I'm not a lawyer, thank goodness. I give all the credit to them, specifically Mr. David Hirsch, who works with Tim, does a fantastic job, and he is the technical resource in reviewing all this and making sure we're dotting all of our I's and crossing our T's. So I just want to say thank you for them. Can we go ahead and move that? So just as a quick review, this is a triennial process. The fire code is only updated every 3 years, thank goodness, again, because it is an exhaustive document. When we do that, we're required as a community services district to adopt the code and or modify it. We can make it more restrictive, but we can't make it less restrictive. And this is our responsibility now to go ahead and make these changes and updates to the code that are relevant to Cambria. If we do not do that, we are then bumped back to the very minimum implementation of what the code allows. So that's why we have this process in place. This is something we've done for a number of years now. This is a normal process. We did this 3 years ago. Most of the stuff that are in the code right now as local amendments are things that have been there for a long time. There's very minor changes and improvements. It's also important to recognize that we try to do this collectively with the other departments and municipalities in the county. The reason I say that is because if you have different enforcement criteria, street to street or community to community, it's very difficult for the builders and designers and architects, and then ultimately the people applying for that have different responsibilities and meet different criteria. So what you're seeing today in this presentation is something that is very similar to the other municipalities that are going through this same process. There are minor tweaks and fluctuations because not every community is the same. For instance, one of the things you'll see here is that we do not allow open burning, or we do not allow fireworks possession or use in this community for obvious reasons. And yet in other communities, they do allow those type of things. So those are the minor variances we see, but the code as a whole is something that is adopted. So can we go ahead? So the timeline on this is Mr. Weigel has already kind of talked about that. It's the fact that we have to present this resolution to you. You guys are going to be looking at that today. There are findings behind this. Ultimately, you vote on the resolution. We now present this towards for the December meeting as a public hearing. And then ultimately, once approved, we have an extra layer. Since we are not an incorporated city, we now have to take this to the County Board of Supervisors for ultimate approval. And we've already been in contact with them, and they're anticipating that down the road. For the next slide. That being said, to delve into this relatively quickly, if you look at the what we're talking about, there's a justification for how we do this, and that's allowed by the Health and Safety Code. So if you look at Exhibit A that's in your packet, we define all of the justifications here by what they allow, and those are climate, topographical, and then geological uniqueness levels, if you will, to the community. The document is here written for you to review. It is something that is very similar to what we presented this last time. Specific to the ordinance, there are changes to certain chapters relevant to things that are specific to Cambria. So, for instance, in Chapter 1, that is the generalized chapter in regards to what happens for title and stuff specific to the community. There are some minor changes there in regards to making it local, so we add language in there that we adopt it, and we put in the Cambria Services District as the governing agency. We limit some use in regards to occupancy for when people can actually take occupancy for when they're building or doing amended projects. They can't just go in and get in there before it's been approved and reviewed by me and or the county. We define a fee schedule for how we go ahead and deal with the application process, and then we actually develop the Board of Appeals for people that want to find some kind of alternative means and methods, and congratulations, that's the five of you. There is one additional change this year. It's something that's been in our code in the past. However, this last cycle it was not, and it's just designating the fire officer as a peace officer for the community. That doesn't mean this person, myself, is a gun-carrying cop. That's not the intent of this, and I want to dispel any rumors or innuendo regarding that. This is for the sole purpose of citation authority, which we already have. We have that secondary to this code and the health and safety code. We have citation things that are defined for the ability to charge for people that are non-compliant with defensible space. We have things that are non-compliant in regards to seizure of fireworks. And yet some of those things are not really quantified or empowered correctly. And in talking with legal counsel, we decided this was the best way to proceed. And then ultimately, once this process is done, to clean this up even farther, to define this with a future ordinance down the road, which will address this a little bit more collectively and define that. If we move on to section 202, we're talking about general updates to definitions, and that's just to clarify specifically sky lanterns, which we do not allow in this community, which for obvious reasons, and then for the term of alteration. And the reason why that's important is because of how we review and amend and evaluate a project for people that are looking at a home remodel or alteration. It has to be clearly defined. We move into section 3. This is where we quantify what open burning is and why that's not allowed and why in our community that would be a bad idea. We also define a securing of premises, and the reason behind that is that when we have, let's say that there's a residential fire right now and that there's some kind of damage and people can no longer occupy that building, there are some serious concerns for the property owner in regards to security and keeping things safe. And so we have to figure out how to make sure that that whole premise is secure, and we have to quantify that rather than just arbitrarily say how they do that. Can we move forward? In section 4, we talk about initiation devices, and that deals with fire alarms and how they work, and then also about emergency drills. Section 5, I'm going to spend a little bit more time on specifically because Mr. Schwartz wanted some information here, and this meeting is for him. I want to make sure he understands. Now, he brings up a very good point, because this section in section 5 is incredibly technical, and you might wonder why some of these things are here. First of all, what you see almost everywhere here in the ordinance itself, that the suggested changes are almost verbatim from what we've had in the last number of years. So when we look at this and say we need a road that's certified by 40,000 pounds by a certified engineer, there's technical reasons behind that because of the size of apparatus that we put on there and that needs to be stable for fire engines and other things. Turning radius, the same thing. We have to define if somebody's putting a new road in, they have to be able to actually have a fire engine turn around at a safe distance, and this is all directly out of the code and defined that way. Grade is important because of slippage. So when we talk about a road that is under 12%, it could be a all-weather road that's DG or compact dirt or things like that. When we exceed 12% to 16%, that's when they have to actually put in pavement, because that's when things start to slip in regards to a 40,000-pound fire engine on a hill. And then the width of driveways and the length of driveways are all quantified in here. And then when we have to do turnarounds, when we have to do turnouts, those are all technical things, but it's designed to be able to get a fire engine in safely and then ultimately out safely. Where this is important to realize, we're talking about new construction. We're not talking about taking existing roads, because we can't, I guess technically you can take this code and adopt it and choose to make it retroactive. I don't think you're going to be in your seats very long if you do that, because we don't have the ability to enforce or make those kinds of changes. So what we call those things are existing nonconforming. So if you look at Park Hill, for instance, there's a number of streets on there when you get over to Lancaster and Layton that easily exceed that 16% grade. We can't go back and change that at that point. But if we were designing a city or designing an infrastructure, That's the kind of limitations we would use, and we use that in concert with the same regulations that the county building office enforces. So when the county looks at this, they have the same limitation. If for some reason we are now in a position where you're going to put in a new development in a certain area, we need to meet this criteria. That's where we're going with this. Where we do see this more than anything is that on the relatively few brand new residential build projects that are happening in the community that are maybe on the outskirts, maybe in the Leimert area where we see long driveways and things like that, those for the most part are relatively flat, but we need to make sure that they meet this criteria. So if they're greater than 300 feet, they have to have a turnout in a certain way so we can get apparatus in and out. That's where you might see these kinds of changes or mandates, but we don't go back retroactively and change, tell people they have to change them. That's just not feasible. We also have to deal with gates and barricades in regards to access to these places. So if people want, and they have the legal right to do that, put gates on there, we have to have the ability to get in there for safety reasons, and there's ways to do that that are still offer security for the resident as well. It empowers the fire department to have vehicles towed when they block the roads. A lot of the roads here in the community do not meet the current fire code width standards. So that's why we start looking at things at red striping roads or posting no parking issues. We've talked about some of those things. So we try to create those limitations, but we have to be empowered, going back to the peace officer status, to be able to enforce those kinds of restrictions. So that's why that stuff is there. There is address identification. We actually increase for new builds and remodels the size of lettering and numbering that goes on a home. All of that makes it more easy for us to find you in an emergency. When you call 911 is not one you want to regret. I put the wrong size numbers on the house or they're not in the right place. You want to be able to be found immediately, and that's why it's there. Under Chapter 6, we do not allow unvented fueled heaters for obvious reason. That could create a whole carbon monoxide problem within a community, within a structure. That's been in there for as long as I can remember. The big one that people really question a lot is Chapter 9. Let's go forward. In regards to sprinklers, the code is becoming more and more restrictive in sprinklers, and it is a multi-page somewhat convoluted evaluation process. And the county, along with a number of different municipalities like Cambria, has developed these two documents. And these are the governing documents and how we evaluate a project that comes forward, whether or not we need to sprinkle that facility or offer some kind of alternative means. So this is the evaluation process we use. There's two of those that are there. Let's go ahead and fast forward two. Okay, right there. So moving forward, and I can answer questions specific to technicality on those things if you want to delve into them. I just want to show you that's the kind of stuff we look at when we get the projects that come in for review. We do identify what a false alarm is. And one of the things that most agencies are doing now is trying to recover cost for those type of things. So if a large facility has been built and has a fire alarm that is repeatedly going off, there is a cost associated with responding fire department personnel, apparatus, fuel, all that kind of stuff to it, just to get there and find out that it's not working correctly. Now, there is inherent limitations in how long we can do that, and most municipalities now are charging for that function after the fact. So there's three that are inherently built into the proposed language here. Basically, if you have a new system, we'll head out there three different times. We're still going to go. That's not going to change. But if you cannot coordinate getting that system fixed and repaired, you're going to start being charged for it, is essentially what that says. We will allow occasionally above-ground fuel tanks, but that is something that is relatively rare. And I can tell you that in the last number of years, I've never even seen it allowed. I've never even seen an application for it. But we do have to have it quantified, so you see that in Chapter 23 here. And then jumping forward to Chapter 56 deals with the explosive issues in regards to fireworks. It is completely illegal to own or possess safe and sane fireworks along with illegal fireworks in the community of Cambria. There's a stiff penalty with that. On top of which, if we see them, we seize them. And that usually means we end up calling the sheriff's department and we collect them, and then they all get turned over to the bomb squad. So the intent on all of this is to keep a fire-safe community We don't try to be punitive about it. We just need to be empowered to be able to collect it and make sure that we're doing the right thing. Let's move forward one more. The final thing for you today is the International Wildland Urban Interface Code, and we adopt this as a subsection along with the NFPA 1144 standard. What these are specific to is in regards to construction requirements for new construction and then also for remodel construction in the community. That is because we live in a wildland urban interface. We have trees right up against buildings. We're in the middle of this beautiful forest here, and we need to make sure that anybody building here is meeting the highest level of safety that they can. That being said, there has always been a little bit of confusion in regards to, okay, do we label it a low, a moderate, a high, a very high? If you look at some maps from PG&E, you see a different class rating in regards to what they evaluate the community at. If you look at the state fire marshal or you look at the CAL FIRE model, you'll see different models there. The most recent models that CAL FIRE has are from 2007. They're numerous years old. They're in the process of updating those. But nobody would argue that we don't live in a very high danger zone potentially because of that. So, therefore, what we have done is in the proposed document here is rather than even go down the road of trying to give people or give myself as the evaluator the opportunity to define different levels of fire safety zones within the community because it can vary street to street, block to block, we've eliminated everything and eliminated the confusion, and everything is identified as a very high. Otherwise, we have a very difficult time in applying the same standards. Mr. Ober brought up some of the same concerns. Those standards need to be applied universally throughout the community because that's how we're going to maintain a fire-safe community. And then when you start seeing and getting phone calls about people getting their insurance dropped or things like that, these are the kinds of things that we can utilize to make that process a little bit more seamless. So I'm free to go in. I'm happy to go into any of this in more depth if you would like, if you'd like more specific questions answered. This is all presented to you now. I believe the intent is for you to look at the resolution and consider that as an adoption for the justification behind this with those climate, geological, and topographical changes to set the date for the public hearing, which would be next month. And then once authorized, we would then take this to the county for final approval. So I'm over to you for any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Great presentation. Very much gave us a lot of clarity on all the information that we had to read. Anyone have a question? Oh, Director Rice.
I'll start with the first question is this is what's going to become what's in this
Section
thing?
Six.
Exactly. So this book here is the fire code we're talking about. This is the brand new 2019 California Fire Code.
Okay.
And when we're talking about waiving the reading of the entire document, this is why you don't want to sit here. This is how
long.
And
that's why we don't want to have the whole thing in
exactly.
Our ordinance.
Exactly. So what you're doing by adopting the ordinance as written is you're adopting the fire code as is with the following amendments and changes, which are all identified in the ordinance.
And is that document available at the district office?
It is.
So if somebody wants to see the whole thing?
It
so
is.
That,
per requirement
building,
of the health and safety code?
Okay.
It is available there. It has always been available there. So if you look there, there's a full set of not only that, but the accompanying documents. We also offer a comparative document of the 2019 California Building Code. Now, we don't go to the extent of adopting that, but that's solely because all building review happens through the county because we're not incorporated. If this was a incorporated city, we would have to go to the extent of bringing that document into our ordinance as well.
Okay, and on specific items, number 26, I'm looking at page 25 in the agenda packet. Number 26 is CFC section 903.3.7.
Okay.
What is a fire department connection?
Absolutely. I did skip over that, and I apologize. For the commercial and business and industrial projects that require fire sprinklers, we require them to put in a connection and a hydrant near that facility that allows us to augment the sprinkler system. So in a residential setting, we don't do that. That's not required by code. We do require they sprinkle the building, but it is a smaller system, and the intent of that system is to arrest the fire long enough to get people out of the building. In a commercial industrial setting and businesses, the intent is to hopefully put the fire out. It's a much more beefy system. There is a connection that is set up outside the building. We call it an FDC, a fire department connection. And if that fire, if a sprinkler head has popped or it is now dispensing water, we can now not only allow the water to come through the municipal water supply system and put that out, we can connect lines from the fire engine to that system, augment what's already happening, and enhance that while we're deploying personnel and lines into the building as well. So the fire department connection is required for all new commercial, business, and industrial applications.
So essentially, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So essentially what happens is in a commercial, we're talking about not residential, we're talking about commercial.
Yeah, you'd be talking about like a hotel.
You connect your sprinkler system to something that the water goes through the meter, I would assume.
It does.
And then there's an additional connection that allows for you to add to that water through the fire?
It does, because we are able to boost the pressure of what's going there and deliver a greater quantity of water.
Okay.
So it's called an OS&Y or an outside stem and yoke. If you look at some of the commercial applications, hotels are a great example. And usually people don't even realize they're there. But if you look outside of some of them, you'll see a manifold of big fancy tubes. Sometimes they're painted red. There's a connection on the front of those that we have the ability to put hoses into.
But our fire hydrants aren't plumbed different. I mean, they're all connected to the same distribution system,
right? It's plumbed to the same distribution system, but we can bring the pressure up through the fire engine and increase the water delivery through that
mechanism. Thank you. Part of why I'm asking that question is related to another question that I have, which is the impact on the potential water demand, both long-term and during emergencies, if let's say somehow every house got sprinklered, or 50% of the houses got sprinklered.
Right.
Do we have any idea what effect that setup has, either during emergency for water supply?
We do,
or
to
long
a certain
term
extent.
For demand.
You have to remember that the purpose of the water sprinklers in a residential setting primarily, because let's talk about that, is to arrest the fire to get people out of the building safely. They are designed for that single application, not all the houses in the community going off at once because of a wildfire going off. It's not designed that way. Now, there are formulaic tables and information in the appendices of the fire code, which we are adopting as well. It's in its entirety, that define the water delivery requirements for a certain building, where it is, what its use is, how it's going to be habitated, if you will. Mm-hmm. So the requirements are different for a residential structure versus a commercial structure in a motel setting, it's going to be even higher in an industrial setting. And so we have to meet that fire flow requirement by testing the hydrant. So that's why sometimes you'll see us out there at a fire hydrant flowing a little bit of water with some fancy gauges, because we're measuring that quantity and pressure. If it doesn't meet the right requirements, then the system has to be enhanced, or they have to provide some kind of alternative means. Typically what happens is we end up adding in another hydrant. Very few times we'll actually end up increasing the size of the delivery line in the street. When we're talking about remodels for things that are already existing, we're almost always talking about increasing meter size to the structure, because all the water flowing for residential use is also going to be flowing through that same meter for delivery for fire sprinklers. So we do measure that. If you're asking, do we have enough for a cataclysmic event, we absolutely do not.
Nobody. I don't think any community would for a cataclysmic. I mean, but I'm trying to, because these two layers, the water for fire protection in addition to water for general use, and we have to make projections going forward, and I'm just trying to determine if there would be an effect as we determine the next time we determine projections going forward for demand, if that's going to make a difference.
It could, and I've had discussions with Mr. Green in regards to the water department, and we can do a fairly close evaluation and projection of what it would cost water use-wise in gallons to extinguish a fire in a certain house. Because I can measure the quantity of water going through a certain line, through a certain kind of a nozzle, and tell you that on average, we're going to be delivering X number of gallons for a certain amount of time, then we can back measure all of that.
And we can't do projections on whether we're going to have fires and the water we would use to put them out. That's just silly to have that built into a projection demand. But I understand what you're saying. I just want to make sure that it's not left out if it's something we
should be considering.
Now, here's a non-fire trained person question for you.
Okay.
Fire marshal, fire chief. Is there, I know we don't have right now technically somebody that has that title, fire marshal. Is there a difference between the roles?
There is, and you do, and it's me.
Okay, so you're the chief and the marshal.
So,
like I said, uneducated fire.
No, that's okay. I'm glad to provide the clarification. In years past, we have had a fire prevention officer, which would be qualified as the fire prevention person or the fire marshal. There's different terminology you can use. That person is primarily responsible for all plan review, code development, code enforcement, all of things relevant to fire code. For the last number of years, we have not been able to have that person on staff for financial reasons.
Okay.
Which means it doesn't go away. It just has to be done, and now I wear two hats.
Okay. I'm just leery of stretching you too thin because right now we're okay having you do both of those positions. But if we were, say, in 5 years to start allowing people to build, if that becomes a case... Or as the ADU, the accessory dwelling unit law, goes in and we have to start approving those, that we may see an uptick in the duties of the person who has to do that part of the job.
We already see that uptick significantly, and I don't mean to be flippant by any means, but if I showed you how much time I put on both sides of this, I think you'd be surprised. It's definitely two full-time jobs.
Right, and so maybe that's something that the board needs to review going forward if there's a way that we can help support either the training for somebody who's already on staff to take over some of those duties or hiring an additional.
So let me thank you. In our budget, we have identified training monies for my personnel, and that is for everything to become an engineer, to be qualified to work on the boats, to be able to do anything else. One of the things that I am stressing to have my personnel to be as well-rounded as possible is to expose them to all of this. So one of the big things, one of my captains, for instance, has taken three of the different courses this last year alone for this fire marshal component to be able to get other people trained.
Wonderful.
Because we need redundancy in everything we do. Not going to be all do it all myself. So.
My last comment is I didn't notice in the narrative anywhere where it speaks about how many tourists a year we have. You do speak about the hotels and the commercial areas, but it might be helpful in the findings to say we have X number, generally average X number of visitors annually or something, even though the reports that we're getting as a board show that that's not the majority of the calls that you get. It is still part of the situation here.
I agree. It would be very valuable information. Per my understanding of the health and safety code, it's not a justifiable or quantifiable reason to identify for amending the code, like the climate geography or topography is. However, we could get that information and pass along because it would be valuable to understand. Absolutely.
The findings, though, there isn't really any change in the findings other than the fact that there's a new code at the state level that we need to adopt. That's actually what the main finding is, why we need to do this.
Yes.
The rest of the findings are related to why we're changing some of those.
Those haven't really changed over the last number of cycles because those facts are in existence already.
Well, but neither has the tourism is kind of what I'm saying. Is the population and the tourism is probably... I don't know how the rest of the board feels, but it would be nice if we had. Thank you for allowing me the extra time.
Sure. Director Steidel.
My question is very quick. It's just in going through and doing these changes and this kind of review, are there other areas of the district code that these changes or adjustments would potentially migrate into that we need to be sensitive to, and is that something normally that you review with the staff as part of the process that you go through when you're compiling the review for the code?
That's a great question. Typically, it does not impact those areas. The only area where I see where it may is in regards to the fee structure. Some of those things are already identified, but we have an adopted fee schedule now, and that we're not proposing to change that or alter it. This amends only Chapter 6 of the identified municipal code for the CCSD.
Excellent. Thank you.
Dr. Howell.
Yeah, a couple. One on page 23 regarding the sky lanterns. I'm wondering why there are any exceptions. Why are they not simply prohibited, period?
The only exceptions that have been allowed in any municipality that I'm aware is battery-powered devices for the purposes of religious-type ceremonies. They are not allowing live fire. But we need to quantify that so that we could still have it. Rather than just unilaterally say you can't do it, we need to give them an alternative means and methods to provide that if they need it for some reason.
It might be, would it not be more reasonable to put something like that in the code that's an alternative other than an actual burning fire?
It could. This is the language that the county prevention officers have adopted unilaterally, so which is why it's being presented this way. We could change it if necessary. I don't know that we need to make it more restrictive because we understand what the intent is. And it's actually further clarified when you go into the definition section, which is the amendment to Chapter 2, where it defines what a sky lantern is and what it can and cannot be. So I think if you use the two together, we'll get to the same point.
Okay. I was just kind of wondering, because with fireworks, there's no ifs, ands, or buts.
There's none. And so exactly.
Sky lanterns are dangerous.
They just don't explode.
true.
Hopefully.
And a couple,
hopefully.
Yeah. A couple of questions. Excuse me. We talk about the non-compliant roads. Mm-hmm. Since we can't do anything with the existing road, but would it not be appropriate for such roads to be identified and brought to the attention of the county public works? So, because it seems to me it would be appropriate that they should be paved if they're...
Absolutely. That's a great question. Good observation. We do that now. We have a contact with the county, and we identify areas that we have concerns relative to, can I get my fire engine even through there because of how it's happening. We have had certain roads marked as no parking, at least on one side, to limit because of those capabilities or lack of capabilities. Mm-hmm. There is a financial component to going back and paving all of those, and that's typically borne by the people that live on that street. They don't arbitrarily do that usually. They usually go back and charge the people that live there. And then I know somebody brought up earlier in regards to vegetation obstructing roads and things like that. If it's in any kind of a county or state jurisdictional right-of-way, I encourage you to let me know about that because, again, we turn that over to them as well. So county tends to be pretty proactive about that. We'll give them half a dozen different locations. The height's not high enough. The road, there's too much vegetation cutting in. Yeah. They'll come out and clear all those at the same time. We're not as lucky, if you will, with Caltrans. They tend to be not as responsive, but we do give them information. Burton Drive is a perfect example. Yeah. Depending on which direction you're coming from, there are some bushes that encroach in regards to how somebody can come up. That's been brought up a number of times, but that is on state property. And so we can't arbitrarily go out and clear that, even though that might be the best course of action. Sometimes we don't want to trespass on their property, but we are trying to do that. Please bring it to our attention because we'll pass it on.
So it doesn't hurt to make noise.
Please do, yes.
Two more. You referred to number 25 on page 25. What are group R residences?
That's all residential. That's all. Every occupancy falls into a certain group, and your home is an R3. Okay. Hotels and motels would be an R1 or an R2. Everything is defined that way. I could give you the rest of them if you really want to know, but the code identifies what those are, not only in the fire code but the building code, and then it puts different restrictions on there, not only for what it's intended to be used for, but then what and who occupies it, because that can change over time. Mm.
And the last thing, and in reference to above-ground fuel tanks, in view of the fact that many people are now looking at auxiliary generators, some of those will be propane-powered, but it is not to say that some might not be diesel. Is there any at least attempt to educate people as to what is safe and how to do this? Because I foresee a serious problem with this.
I do, too. Thank you for bringing that up. That's not something we can quantify specifically in the ordinance. However, the LPG tanks that you're talking about are specifically identified in the new code. And so, for instance, I had the opportunity to meet with a subgroup of NCAC last week, I believe it was, talking about this specific application, because secondary to the power shutoffs and people having medical necessity or other things, they need to provide an alternative fuel source. So the most popular versions of that are either going to be solar with some kind of battery backup, which is already happening. That's been happening for quite some time. Probably the one that makes the most sense is plumbing natural gas, because it's already going to your property and you don't need to go through an evaluation process or permitting process for that, as long as it's being done by a licensed person that is doing it to code. Where we get into some concerns, and where some members of the NCAC and others in the community, rightfully so, are concerned about putting a 200-gallon tank on their property, and there are restrictions in regards to where, what size it can be, where it can be, easement issues, how close it can be to the home versus the property line. And I'm sure you can see how that's going to be problematic in a community where your average property parcel size is about 50 by 75. So we need to figure out how to do that and maybe provide other means to do that. In some of the larger parcels, if you're looking at something that is an acre or larger and you're far enough away, there may be ways to do that by the code, but there are specific limitations, but they're already identified in one of the chapters, which is why you don't see it as an amendment here.
Thank you.
Yep. All right, thank you, Director Steidel.
One clarification. When you were addressing the initial question that Director Howell had about roads being paved,
yes, ma'am.
Was there the inference then, if you have a potential impact to fire truck access for that type of road, that the county could in fact be tapped to be able to pave that road, or is it still the responsibility of the homeowners on that road to assume the cost of the paving?
That really is a question for the county, but what we're talking about here is new installation of roads. So we can't take these amendments and go to the owners or to the county and say, you're going to now have to pave this because it's non-compliant. It unfortunately falls into that between a rock and a hard place area. Now, if we're building that new infrastructure brand new, we could make that requirement.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. One more. Mr. Key would like to ask it. Terrific. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Very comprehensive, obviously.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, Director Rice has another question.
When I first moved here, there was a campaign going on, probably maybe a year after I got here, that Chief Putney was ensuring all the addressing was visible. There was kind of a big campaign. I'm sure you remember. You were on the fire department at the time. And I just want to reinforce to folks, because we haven't talked about it, your address needs to be visible from the public road space. It should be reflective. It should be at least 6 inches tall, at least 1 inch or 2 inches wide, so that it's easily found. Because if you have an emergency, you want them to be able to tell which house they're supposed to go to. And written out numbers don't count. If you want to have your house number be SIX1N, I can't even spell numbers right now. That's what happens when you're on the road for 4 hours before a meeting. That you have to actually have the numerals and not the spelled out words. Correct. And I just want to make sure that everybody goes outside at some point. If it's not today, then tomorrow. Yep. Go and look at the front of your house from the road, not the middle of it, but from the road, and make sure that it's visible and reflective. The other thing is I don't find there's good justification to put the California Penal Code peace officer authority back in. I don't find it's not clear why it was removed to be a good reason for us to reinstate it, because there probably was a reason if it was in there and got removed. Just because we don't know what it was That doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to go back in. I also don't know, I don't have a clear enough understanding, and I fully respect all of our safety officers, no matter what kind they are, and they all need to have the appropriate authority to do their jobs. But I have no idea what effect this will have for us. And again, it was in there. It got taken out in 2010, but it's not clear why. That's not a good reason to put it back in. Maybe Mr. Carmel has an idea on that one.
Can I ask what your concern is with putting it back in?
I don't know why we're putting it back in. Just because it was, and I don't know what specifically it's not really explained what the peace officer authority is.
Well, I can tell you what it isn't. It doesn't authorize carrying a weapon. It authorizes citation authority generally.
And he wouldn't have the fire department, not just Chief Hollingsworth, but the fire department wouldn't have citation authority otherwise.
That's my understanding.
So the lot clearing thing isn't a citation. That's actually a whole different thing.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right, anyone else? Yes, Vice President Farmer.
First, I want to thank the chief for a thorough examination and exploration of this document that we're dealing with and all the fine questions and comments from the board. I want to allude to something else that's in here, and this probably might be more applicable to the next item we're discussing, item 4C, agenda item 4C. But since it happens to be in 4B on page 16, and this is under the Cambria community profile in the climactic area, so I just want to read a couple of items here. First off, I'll take my glasses off here. Because of weather patterns and limited water sources, Cambria, like few other California communities, has long established and participated in water conservation programs to prevent water rationing. During some years, water rationing and limitations on water use has been instituted and required. Water availability may be further limited in the future due to limited storage capacity and increased consumption, as well as the climatic conditions which further impact the already minimal annual rainfall. And then if I turn to page 17, kind of in the second paragraph here, and it says, the Cambria Community Services District is currently working toward a multi-year plan to improve the community's water storage shortfall. Until a more reliable and permanent supplemental water supply is secured, Cambria is in and will remain in a water shortage emergency. So as I said, even though this is in this particular item 4B, I thought I'd read it now since it appears to be applicable to the next item. So thank you very much.
All right, any other comments? We have some work to do here. First, we need to adopt the resolution 39-2019.
So moved. This is to adopt the resolution and introduce the ordinance? No, just the resolution. Okay, I move we adopt resolution 39-2019.
I'll second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Can we have a roll call, please?
Director Rice?
Aye.
Director Steidel?
Aye.
Director Howe?
Aye.
Vice President Farmer?
Aye.
President Pearson?
Aye. Next, we need to introduce the ordinance.
I move we introduce ordinance 022019 by title only and waive full reading.
I'll second.
All right, we don't need a roll call for this one, do we?
Well, no, but we do need to read the title.
Oh, the title is, where's the title?
It's on page 21.
Thank you. I move that we approve, introduce ordinance number 022019, ordinance amending Chapter 6.04 of the Cambria Community Services District Municipal Code and adopting and amending the 2019 edition of the California Fire Code, the 2018 edition of the International Wildland Urban Interface Code, and the 2018 National Fire Protection Association Standard 1144. And waive full reading. Because the time
Very
is
good.
Up.
All right, and we hereby schedule a public hearing for December 19th, 2019, regular board meeting to consider adoption of the ordinance.
We'll need a vote, a roll call vote on that, on okay. the ordinance.
So let's have a roll. We can just have a roll call vote. We don't need a motion on that. Go ahead.
Director Rice?
Aye.
Director Steidel?
Aye.
Director Howe?
Aye.
Vice President Farmer?
Aye.
President Pearson?
Aye. And finally, we are directing the staff to submit Resolution 39, 2019, Ordinance 02-2019, and all appropriate and required documentation to the County of San Luis Obispo as required by the California Health and Safety Code, Section 13869.1.
Seven.
Okay.
Not to confuse anything, but the roll call vote was for the ordinance, so we'll have to have a motion on the public hearing.
Oh. Okay, I move we direct staff to schedule a public hearing for December 19th and to submit Resolution 39, 2019, and Ordinance 02-2019, and all appropriate and required documentation, et cetera.
I'll second. Second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second.
Director Rice?
Aye.
Director Howe?
Aye.
Director Steidel?
Aye.
Vice President Farmer?
Aye.
President Pearson?
Aye. Yes, thank you, Chief. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Marshal Chief.
All right, moving on, we're now on item number C. Mr. Weigold, would you like to introduce this one, or do you want me to stumble through it?
I can kick it off.
Thanks.
So, Mr. President, staff's recommending that the Board of Directors discuss and consider adoption of Resolution 42-2019, rescinding the Stage 2 water shortage condition and declaring a Stage 1 drought watch condition. We've also added a slide, if we can bring that up, to further clarify the staff report, because I recognize that there's a lot of information in here, but the bottom line is we can discuss here in a few minutes is there's essentially no difference between the two stages. We can discuss as we go along here.
Yeah. Okay, so we're in a Stage 2 right now. But the resolution adopting the Stage 2, when they went from Stage 3 to Stage 2 back in 2017, they eliminated Sections A, E, and C from consideration, okay? So they're no longer in force. So as was quoted in the Cambrian, I believe that what we have is pretty much a toothless conservation program right now. And so the idea behind bringing this up is to see whether we want to at least go back to monitoring how much people are using and perhaps at some point offering assistance as a water audit or something to help them find why they're using more than an allotment. In any case, I have six people who would like to speak on this. I plan to do that first. That's all right with the rest of the board. Okay. All right. So we'll have Ms. Heinrichs first, followed by Mr. Schwartz.
Hello, back to water. The board just approved the fire code, including language regarding Cambria's water storage situation. Quote, Water availability may be further limited in the future due to limited storage capacity and increased consumption, as well as the climatic conditions which further impact the already minimal annual rainfall. Cambria's present water storage capacity is adequate for a response to a single structure fire. While sound management of the water resources is possible, actual demands on our water supply have and will most assuredly increase. That's from your fire chief. He needs the board's support on water storage to fight fires. Cambria residents would be better served by storing water than changing the restrictions. The staff recommendation finds no fiscal impact of the resolution. How can that be? Removing even these minimal water restrictions, which have no teeth, surely is expected to have some impact. Elizabeth Bettenhausen will follow with her comments, and I support her. President Pearson, your assertion that the increased water scarcity justifies removing restrictions is perplexing. Threat of drought and Cambria's usual water requirements, which are, as the Coastal Commission noted, currently adversely affecting Santa Rosa and San Simeon Creeks by existing water extractions to support existing development in Cambria, indicates that the provisions removed from the Stage 2 declaration setting allotments and penalties for overuse should be reinstated. This is an opportunity for Cambria to step up, become a model community for 21st century water use and conservation. Please do not take Cambria in the opposite direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schwartz, followed by Mr. Key.
President Pearson, members of the board and staff, my main concern with this resolution is the timing of it. We are getting into the time of year where the well levels are continuing to drop and there's no rain in the forecast. So we can't actually be sure what kind of severity of drought we may be in before the wells recharge. It would seem like it might be a good idea just to table this until next month to see if the prospects for recharging of the wells are any different. If you pass this today, you may find that next month you have another resolution in front of you to go back to a stage two and all the associated mailings that the staff would have to do. It just seems like if you waited a month, you'd have a much better chance of hitting it right. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Key, followed by Mr. Holland.
Good afternoon, Board. Ted Key, Cambria. I have to agree with Mr. Schwartz. Here we are, middle of November. We've had no rain. Who knows what's going to happen this year? The heavens could part, and the good Lord could drop a lot of water on us or not. Now, I just think that this is a premature decision on your part. I'm not saying that it's something we don't want to do. I think it's something that we eventually do want to do. I just don't think this is the right time to do it. I've had conversations with directors, and I've come to this podium time and again talking about the issue of water management being the real central issue for this district. I really think that the R&I committee has asked you for, or has, put forth that we need some more data, more information on where water is going and how it's being used and so on. I urge you to just table this until you get more information to really say, yeah, this is okay. We can take it off. People can use whatever they want. I just think you're getting the cart in front of the horse, and I've seen this too often with this district, so I'm really going to encourage you to say, let's table this right now. Okay? Thanks.
Mr. Hellman, followed by Ms. Dickinson.
Hi. One thing I just caught after I already submitted my ticket was, Mr. Weigold, you made a comment saying there was no difference between stage one and stage two. Well, if there's no difference, why are we going through this whole exercise? There must be something, or this thing wouldn't be passed. what I came here to say is we're not out of the drought yet. All the scientists, this year is predicted to be a dry year. You had a really good year 2 years ago. Last year was okay. Why don't you wait and see to make sure that we are out of the drought? We're actually in a drought. So stage two seems like it's the appropriate step to take in the conditions that we're in. I don't know who the interests are that might be pushing somewhere that I can't see. I don't know who's, you know, pushing to have this change to a stage one or what the actual benefit of going to a stage one is. But the fact that it's getting this promotion leads me to be a little bit wary of what this is all about. But just stay with stage two and you'll be, I think, on safe ground. You won't be disappointing people when we don't have any rain this year and they have to go back. And I hope you keep the status quo on this one. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dickinson. Followed by Ms. Bettenhausen.
Thank you. I'm just going to quote from a letter from Coastal staff from October of last year regarding changes in drought conditions for the three levels. This was sent to Bob Greshens and to board members in October of last year. So as we noted last week, we recommend you postpone any changes to those criteria until after the county completes its review of the CCSD's follow-up coastal development permit for the emergency/sustainable water facility. Changing the criteria in the midst of the review may slow the permit process and may result in the need to modify the project's EIR, the CCSD's adaptive management plan, the project description that is the basis of the current emergency, because the emergency CDP is based on the Stage 3 criteria in place at the time of permit issuance. Changing those criteria may put into question the applicability and validity of that emergency CDP for any anticipated facility operations that would take place before the CCSD obtains a final follow-up CDP. It says several of the proposed criteria appear arbitrary, and this was last year. But you haven't. There are things that have not been addressed here, and I'm just going to go to the last concluding paragraph or a number of paragraphs from Coastal staff. The existing emergency CDP is based on the Stage 3 criteria in place, and any new Stage 3 criteria would not attach to that emergency CDP and would appear to require its own CDP process should the district seek to use new criteria for use regardless. Furthermore, changing the criteria during the permit review process, as I mentioned earlier, for regularly approved water supply project may result in the need to redo some of the analyses or some of the steps in the permit process. And this seems inadvisable at this stage in the process, including as it would appear that it would lead to significant delay. Finally, while we have not had an opportunity to thoroughly review the proposed changes, it appears that several are arbitrary and not supported by documentation. For example, the proposed criteria would establish a new threshold water levels at particular CCSD wells, but there is no information provided about why those specific levels were selected as thresholds. In short, we recommend you postpone any changes to the Stage 3 criteria until after the current permit review is complete and after we have sufficient time to evaluate the proposed criteria. And that was Tom Lester and Daniel Robinson, who is not there anymore, but Tom Lester certainly is. But I think you haven't gotten into near enough depth. You're wondering why, how much people are using, look at the production. I mean, the production tells you that gives you a very good idea of what we're using. Now, it may not be specific enough, but this makes, I'm going to tell you, this is like one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard from the staff and board. It makes no sense. And if there is no difference between a one or two, going to a level one or two, why are you doing it? That's a question I was going to have for you, President Pearson. You requested the item be brought forth. Why? And by whom? Who told you that this would be a good idea? I want to know who's behind this. Because I don't think you're the one that came up with it. I think someone thought this was a good idea. Was it Mr. Ogren? I don't know. Was it Mr. Weigold? I don't know. And I would appreciate it if Mr. Weigel would pay attention to the meeting. I've been noticing throughout the entire meeting, he's practically glued to his iPhone. I'm offended by that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bendenhausen.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm asking the copies be given to you here. I will also send them by email. You know that in my letter of 10 November to you, I said that this proposed resolution violates Canberra's desire to lead the state as a model for conserving water. I said it acts as when the analysis of existing requirements and the municipal code is inadequate. It is worded in a way that does not straightforwardly say water allotment limits are ended. No attention is given to environmental issues and the climate emergency now upon us. This resolution did not begin with an analysis from a standing committee, nor with an analysis by an ad hoc committee of the board itself. I should have said, and I thank you, Mr. Pearson, for responding to my letter and pointing this out, I should have said water allotment limits are still ended and no surcharges are in place. I went back to the meetings in 2017. I must confess, I had a great deal of fun listening to both those meetings. And I urge you, if you are bored or saddened by the government, watch them. I went back and looked, and President Rice at that time made the motion regarding the stage two. At the end of the motion, it said, we direct the staff to work with the Water Supply Committee to overhaul related ordinances. Because they had seen that the code is inadequate and wrong. Nothing has happened in those 2.5 years on this. We're still waiting for that action to take place. I appreciate it very much, your comments in the Cambrian article, President Pearson. You said we have, quote, we have a toothless conservation program, and end quote, and you said that this discussion, this offers the board today, quote, a good opportunity for a healthy discussion about conservation, end of quotation. Here are my suggestions that your healthy conversation might include. One, accurate and comprehensive data on water production and usage, both historical and projected. Two, updated ordinances grounded in actual data and specifying water allotment according to varying aquifer and well conditions. Three, penalties for violating water allotment. Four, complying with state requirements regarding CCSD's use of Santa Rosa and San Simeon Creeks. I urge you, and I thank Ms. Heinrichs for bringing this up, I urge you to read carefully the staff recommendation concerning application A3-SLOW-19-0199 at the California Coastal Commission meeting yesterday, and I give you the website, dear board, for looking that up. And I think the conservation needs a clear statement about how the climate crisis bears on every policy and resolution that you adopt. I point you to the letter. I give you the site, again, to go to the documentation. The 11,000 scientists from around planet Earth just issued another letter. They listed five urgently needed steps, and I want to say that I highlight two of them for you. And they say, end the destruction of nature and restore forests and mangroves. And they say, shift economic goals away from GDP growth. Both of those are totally germane to this town. The two urgently needed actions have to do with tourism and commercial water allotments, degradation of the creeks, management of the forest, population and housing development, rising sea level, and others. I'm running out of time, and I have run. I will attach, please, my letter to you of the 10th to this, and I'm asking that both letters be incorporated into the record of your meeting today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, public comment is done. I would like to just address one thing. This came from me. It didn't come from anybody behind me or in front of me or beside me. The ordinances, the stage two, basically, as I said, has no enforcement and doesn't even have an allotment as to what people are supposed to be looking at. And so I thought, well, let's bring this forward. I did not do a good job of talking to staff about what I really desired and what I'd really like to have happen. And we probably can't do this today, but would be to have the allotments in the stage. Not necessarily the penalties, but at least let everyone be aware of what the allotments are, okay? And I'm not sure the allotments that we have are correct. I think they're a little skimpy for stage one, but in any case. And then direct staff as to those people that exceed the allotment on every 2 months get a notice with their bill that would say, you know, you're over the allotment. You ought to look at some water conservation and maybe list the usual tips of what they could do, and at the same time offer a water audit for our people to come out there and look at their house and give them some ideas as to what they could do. Replace your shower head, maybe, or replace your toilet if you haven't done that, or you're doing a lousy job on irrigation, here's a drip system that would work much better. Something like that, so that we get conservation back in the minds of our people and we get conservation allotments or something so that people can look at their bill and know, you know, I'm not doing as good a job as maybe I should have. And that was my reason for bringing this forward. I don't care if we table it for 2 months because we need to wait and see what happens with the rain. That's fine. But when we do bring it back in a couple of months, we certainly ought to look at least reestablishing. If we're going to stay with number two, we ought to at least reestablish the allotments so that people know how much they're supposed to be using and in order to conserve. And maybe, you know, if we have to later in the year, if we have to put the penalties back in, we can put the penalties back in. But that was my reasoning for having the discussion today, and I'll now allow further discussion. Director Rice.
So first thing is allotments per permanent residence. Is that supposed to be per billing cycle, which is 2 months, or per month, which is not a full billing cycle? So is that supposed to be, I think, if I remember correctly, it should be 3 units per month.
Correct. That's what's in the ordinance.
Right. So it doesn't say it on the chart, and I just want to make sure people understand. And if you're using 3 units, 6 units, 6 units a billing cycle, what you're looking at is 50 gallons per person per day indoor use. What we're talking about here is something that I ran on in 2012 and reiterated when I campaigned in 2016, which is what we have written down should match what we're actually doing. And when we took that action in 2017 but neglected or decided we weren't going to impose surcharges for people who went over the restricted amount, because let's talk about what a restricted amount and not just an allotment, because there's an amount. Nobody's supposed to be wasting water. We're all supposed to have good fixtures and using it efficiently and not watering the sidewalk and things like that. That's always in effect, no matter what stage, if we are in a stage or not. Stage two was intended at one point to have surcharges to make it mandatory that you keep to the restricted amount that your household is allowed to use. Since we don't have surcharges being implemented right now, we are actually implementing something that more looks like stage one. Now, if it had rained, and it's the middle of November, so who knows, it could have rained by this day, and when you set the agenda, you didn't necessarily know. But one rainstorm, even though it generally tends to fill our aquifers, isn't also a good reason to do something. But I do think that we need to be either, to me, the choice needs to either be we choose that we're in a stage one, which is actually just aligning what the board says we should be in with what's actually happening on the ground, or we say we are in stage two, with all the things that that means, which is mandatory restrictions and potentially surcharges for people who go over, or we table it for another for a time when after it's rained, so we have a better sense of what we're looking at for the rest of for the remaining part of the year. Because I don't want to have happen what happened in 2013, where we did off and on and off and on. Because that's not good for the community. Then no, everybody's, are eggs good for you or are they bad for you? New report comes out, well, they're bad for you. So let's try and be clear for the community's sake, too. But I do, from a sense of let's make sure what's in writing matches what's actually happening on the ground, I think that that's, to me, that's a good justification for changing it to stage one voluntary restrictions. Everybody generally is doing well. If we do table it, what I would like to see coming back is how many people are not complying with a restriction of, say, 6 units for billing cycle. Because knowing that, if we've only got a couple people going over, or it's mainly the commercial going over what their allotment would be, then we have a better sense of what we need to do in terms of restrictions. Because none of these restrictions come from the ordinance. They come from a resolution of the board, which gave more right. flexibility. So none of that is really based on... I also agree with a lot of the comments that were made, because we do need to make sense of whether or not we're in a certain stage based on weather prediction, what we've already used, what's in, you know, what are our well levels. There's a big matrix of things that have to be used to look at whether we're in a certain stage. We were trying to reduce it from the mandatory, really, I don't want to call it a word that has bad inferences, which I can't even think of at the moment, but we were trying to change it from the 2 to the 3 at the time, if I remember correctly, and I think that I support either way. I think we should either go to stage one so we match what's on the ground, or we ask staff to implement stage two as it was in the resolution, which means without surcharges, which is a crazy thing to do, or we bring it back and do what Dr. Bettenhausen said, and we really do look at what does that ordinance say and how do we get that right.
Okay, thank you. Director Seidel.
So the conversation that Director Rice went through initially is actually what was addressing the idea of the verbalization that there is no difference between stage two and stage one. Within the ordinance, there is a difference between stage two and stage one, and it's very specific, and it is more limiting in that there are surcharges and potential violations that can be held. Although the allocation, the allotments, as you'll notice, are at the same level, which is an increase from the stage three. The other thing here that I don't think has really been taken into consideration is trying to understand the impact of the business community, because this is really a focus towards residential, and that is actually the most simplistic part of it, and trying to understand in the time frame, even if there has been business growth of any kind or any other number of conditions that we probably want to take into consideration. But it isn't a matter of just considering residential. It's needing to consider business also. So in many respects, I wouldn't have any problem tabling this right now just to be able to satisfy two things. One, generate additional information for ourselves to be able to look at. And number two, see where we are in terms of potential rainfall that we get in, and to understand the real conditions and levels of the wells. I understand that we get that information in different sources, but if we're bringing something forward to take a look at to be able to make judgment against points of evaluation, we need to have the data associated with those points of evaluation so that we can feel that we've done a considered job in evaluating it for the community. I'll leave it at that for right now. Thank you.
Okay. Director Howell.
Thank you. Now that we've had an explanation, I can see there seemed to be a non sequitur in the agenda packet, where it refers to, in the light of these drought conditions,
right.
we're going to remove the limitations. So I'm glad to hear that that's to understand that. If this were to go forward as it is, I would ask for an amendment that the allocations be retained, because I do not see how you can possibly monitor something if you don't have a, you know, so it doesn't make sense to adopt it, everything except paragraph A in that. That's, but having said that, I too think I don't sense great urgency here. And it is true that you don't know, and we're not going to know until the rainy season's almost over, whether we can, whether we truly are, whether we can reasonably expect that we're out of a drought. Drought is a funny thing. You don't know you're in it until you're in it, and the same way you don't know you're out of it until you've had sufficient rain. And it's a little premature at this point, I think, to predict that. But having said that, I think delay may be the way to go here. May I offer a suggestion? It seems to me that this would be very good material for the Resources and Infrastructure Committee to look at. I think that we may perhaps an initial report from them, perhaps with the assistance of staff, might be a first shot at trying to bring. I really do respect the idea that what we are doing needs to be reflected in our code, in our ordinances. We shouldn't be just making it up as we go along. That's. So definitely, I think it's important that we do deal with this. May I suggest, though, that we let the minds of the R&I committee commence the work, and perhaps they can present us with something that might lay out the questions or perhaps propose, I don't know. I will say that I think that committee is very balanced, and I think we'd probably get a pretty good, it might be good, just as starters, I think it might be good. Anyway, I've said enough on that.
Okay. Vice President Farmer.
Being the, having been appointed to the chairmanship of the R&I committee, we'll be addressing that. I've already been giving it some thought. And with regard to this particular item, it would seem to me, instead of moving down to stage one, what we should have been considering today is putting the so-called teeth back into stage two and making sure that people are using the correct amount of water. I think, you know, one of the great things about this community is how much we've always stepped up when there was a need for water conservation. But we've had a lot of, I will say, since I don't have a real number, but we've had people to move to this community since 2014 that maybe aren't as aware of how problematic things have been in the past and how they could easily be that way in the future. And so my concern would be, This doing this alone doesn't send a message of more strict water conservation, but makes it a more lax consideration from the board and the district, which doesn't appear to make sense to me. I seem to recall back in 2017 when we were removing the teeth from stage two, that Director Rice and myself voted against that, but the other three members voted in favor of it. And I feel that this is where we should go back to. With regard to implementing surcharges and penalties, this may be a little bit premature in doing that, but once again, we should always be thinking drought conditions. If it happens that we get an adequate supply of water as we did in the recent rainy season, then we should count our blessings. But that should be our mindset. I think it mentions in Kathy Tanner's. I want to thank Kathy, by the way, obviously because she's working fewer hours now. She isn't able to always address whatever it is that we're discussing here at the board and with the district concerns. But this particular article, and by the way, Kathy, happy birthday. I know it's right here, and this is, I just want to thank you. And this is your gift to us around your birthday, is this excellent article with regard to addressing this issue of water conservation. So as I said, I think just making people more aware of the need to conserve, it mentions in the article here, in the Cambrian, and I encourage everyone to read it, and I believe this is a quote of Director Pearson. He says, the state's goal by 2025 is an indoor per person daily limit of 55 gallons. this, we live in a very special place. You know, we should be trend setting, goal setting, and we should be embracing this. And we might already be at this with 2 units per month. I was just using 5 gallons per day. Obviously, as we've done in the past, we should be making every effort. Everyone in this community should be making every effort to use as little water as possible, so we don't necessarily have to fall back into stage 3 limitations. But if that happens, then so be it. But that's personally how I feel. And there's probably more that I want to say, but I can't think of it right now. But that's my take. Oh, I want to say one more thing. This goes back to what Elizabeth Bettenhausen said in public comment when she was quoting the Native American, the Navajo poet. And he said, Navajos don't own land. We belong to the land. The earth is alive. We've fallen into this, consumerism, private property mindset that we live in the in the 20th century, at least, and we have forgotten the reverence that we should have for Mother Earth. And, you know, we're not here to exploit nature. We're here to live in harmony with nature, which I think implies using as little water as possible to make sure that, like I said, that we're in harmony with Mother Earth and that that water is available not just for us, but the critters that live out there that utilize the water and the creeks that are running. Just for, if nothing else, I don't know about you, but going out to where water is flowing, whether it's a river or a creek, is so soul-nourishing. And like I said, just being in touch with the vitality of Mother Earth and how she serves us and we should be in service to her, that to me is where it's at. If I'm a little off base with regard to this item, so be it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Director Stidell.
One thing for consideration, there was a reference earlier that we're not in a position where there's something of immediacy going on. We have time for consideration on this and to gather information to help ourselves make good decisions within the community and within the board. One indicator is that... Thank you. So one indicator for that is just the mapping of the water usage that's happened since the relief from being in a stage 3. Now, the water usage has increased, but it hasn't gone haywire. It hasn't gone right up, you know, to the top of the world in terms of consuming water and, you know, leaving our taps running all day or anything else, any kind of irresponsible behavior. People have contained their water usage. So although the stage 2 items, if you go down the left-hand side of that, those individual increments within the ordinance are actually Section A, Section B, C, D, and E. And you can read the information yourself to see how it relates. But if we still had the 3 units a month, so 6 months or 6 units for a billing period, residential, I think you'll find that we haven't even been using water at that level. People are still containing themselves in trying to keep within what had been established in the stage 3. I don't think I'm the only one. I go out beyond the 4 units on an occasional basis. If I've got a family coming in with the 4 kids and they're here for a week and going to the bank, going out to the ocean every day, yeah, I'm going to go over 4 units. But I don't see that there's some immediate need or issue to, for instance, impose the stage 2 items of A, the allotment, B, or C, the monitoring, and E, the violation portion back into our structure right now. I'd like to suggest, for instance, one of the reasons for doing that, if we were to do that today, we would be immediately opposing imposing actions on the community, not only residential but business. We, you know, we forget that we're into our tourist season now, and if we are going to turn around and impose restrictions on business all of a sudden and catch them blindsided without having to do any prior planning for how they may adjust to the things that they need to do because of the imposition of an allocation, I think that we're also remiss to that portion of the community, and we need to keep that in mind and, seriously consider the implications of it. And one other item in reference to some conversation that had gone on here had to do with the stage two having penalties associated with it. It doesn't. It has surcharges, but it does not have penalties. And I just wanted to clarify that. The only place where penalties existed were in the stage three. That's it.
Okay, thank you, Director Rice.
For reference, if you have two people in your house and you have a bill that says 8 units, you're using 50 gallons per person per day. If you have one person in your house and you pay a bill that's 6 units, you're using about 75 gallons per day. So it makes sure, so because it's hard to tell. I mean, 3 units, 6 units, I mean, those units are 748 gallons. It's like trying to calculate some of the other bizarre British-derived measurements that exist in the world. We don't, and a 748 is actually because it's, I believe that's because it's a cubic foot or 100 cubic feet. I can't remember, one or the other. So, which then we convert into all these weird measurements. But just so people are aware, if you're using 50 gallons or less per day, if you've got two people and you're using less than 8 units, you're succeeding at meeting this goal, just for yourself, so you know that's the situation. I am very glad that we're having this discussion, and I think that it is critical that we do either say. Because stage two isn't from the ordinance, so the stage two that was implemented didn't have surcharges in it, because that was what was implemented didn't have surcharges. And I appreciate that. Why are we doing something that's supposed to be mandatory that has no way for us to say, hey, you're out of line here? So we either need to pass a new resolution that says something different about what it is, and then refer something to committee or some such thing. Or I'm okay with tabling this, because it doesn't really change anything for the community if we take this action today, correct?
Correct.
What it does, except what it does say, is it says to the other resource agencies, it says to staff, it says to the community, we are trying to be more responsible about the stewardship of our resources and be clear about what we're saying and doing and writing, so that we're not, don't have all this mismatch between, I mean, we get confused about these stages because they're not the ones that are written in the ordinance. They're ones that we put in place because of resolutions. And that's an entirely appropriate way to act if you're actually acting on good information. And so I think what I think this says is not that we are relaxing regulations. I think what it says is that we're trying to get everything straightened out and in line with what it says on paper.
Yeah, ma'am. If you'd like to speak, you need to turn in the slip, and I'll be glad to recognize you.
May I?
So, Director Howell.
Yes, I'd like to make a motion. I move that this matter be referred to the Resources and Infrastructure Committee, and as well instructing them to pay due attention to the needs of businesses, and furthermore to come back to this board no later than the second meeting in January. By then we'll know if it rained or not.
Okay. I was going to suggest February, but that's okay.
Okay, February is even better.
If I could just make a comment, by the way. with regard to Ms. Bettenhausen's letter that she's given the board here, where she says the CCSD conservation program needs, and item number one is, accurate and comprehensive data on water production and usage, both historical and projected. And we recently had a three-month investigation, so to speak, by three members of our committee on the water usage, both historical and projected. So we already have that information. And with regard to water production, we can be endeavor to be on top of that as well. So thank you. Actually, I think what we should probably do is just ask Ms. Bettenhausen for water production, because I think she's totally on top of that anyway. So we'll just anticipate her being at our next meeting to provide all that information. Thank you.
Okay. We have a motion. Do we have a second of that?
I'll second that.
Okay.
Further discussion?
Yeah. I'd like to recognize this lady who's mm-hmm. turning in a slip here. Yes, ma'am. Would you like to come forward?
Oh.
Yes, ma'am.
Rita Burton, Cambria. I thought, and I could be wrong, that it's three units per person per billing cycle every 2 months. It's not?
Per month. And the ordinance?
The ordinance actually says units per month.
Per month.
And it's three per person.
Per month.
Per month.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it is. Director Rice.
I think the referral to R&I is appropriate. I also think it is overly vague and doesn't provide enough direction for what we're looking to get back from them. Do we want them to examine what the resolution that we were looking at that was passed in 2017? Do we want them to look at how do we declare stage 1, 2, 3? This all comes from my experience being on a committee called the Water Emergency Citizens Committee, which we took almost a year just to get up to speed on some of the things. So, I mean, I created a spreadsheet that I'm using to this day so that we could go between gallons per day and units per billing cycle, because it's confusing when you can't get that. We had people that were part of the business community, people that we had a representative of large families, small families. So I think that it's a good motion and it's a good intent. I think it needs more clarity, or we're going to send R&I down 17 roads at one time and not get anything back, whether it's February next year or the year after. Because it does take, even though we have a standing committee that's more up to speed than we were at the time when we got appointed in 2009, I'm concerned it's not specific enough for what the board is looking to get a recommendation about how should we act going forward on this issue.
Yeah, I think if you really look at the ordinance, the way it's written and everything, and it refers to Section 8 as well as Section 4, that it's very, very complex. And I think if we're going to do anything more than ask them to recommend either going to stage one or staying in stage two, that we'd be remiss, because there's way too much complication. And that is something that we need to attack, but it's going to take a lot of time. And I think next week we're going to talk about getting a consultant on board early to help us with some of this and changing our conservation ordinances and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think we should wait maybe until next week as far as what we charge the R&I committee with. So
maybe if I could offer a friendly amendment,
sure,
to say that we ask the R&I committee or a subcommittee thereof to examine the supply issue this year, the potential demand this year, and going into, let's say, this water year, which is October 1st to September 30th. So what do we look like right now this year? Do we need to implement any restrictions, whether they're voluntary or mandatory? because then that gives the board some answers that we can then discuss further. How do we approach whether we need mandatory restrictions, which means surcharges, or something entirely else?
Yeah, I would accept that. The second would accept.
I'm trying to understand.
The specific amendment is to look at this year, this current year,
demand
water
and,
year.
Demand and usage.
Demand and use and supply.
Year. Right. And I have absolutely no problem with that. I just don't know that we should put the onus of making the decision of whether it should be mandatory or voluntary on okay.
No, but they should look at, those are some of the options that they should look at, because they're not going to make the decision, but I think that getting a recommendation, they say, okay, the well levels are like this, and for previous years it looked like this.
Yeah. Right. Based
we need to do
data.
Mandatory restrictions right now because we don't know when it's going to rain or whatever. So that limitation, if that's acceptable to the maker in the second.
Right. I will say that I don't think that they need to involve themselves in looking at the three stages and in some way redefining them in any way.
Right.
Number one, just in terms of putting limitations on what our expectations are, to verbalize that at least.
Right.
I had a second thought. I know that it was second thought was in there someplace. It'll come up. I think that looking at the limitations of what the stage one and the stage two are, and trying to understand how you would make the decision, what are the monitoring points? In other words, you know, is it the model that we say isn't doesn't address it appropriately, or is it just a history of well condition over certain periods of time? Maybe being aware of what some of those have been in the past, and to identify all of the potential ways in which it could be measured would be of value, because it could help us make a decision about what we really should be using as a mechanism for making the evaluations.
Okay, or what they would recommend. But you good? All right. So we have a recommendation and a second on sending it to the R&I committee and obviously tabling it until February. Can we have a roll call vote?
Director Howell?
Aye.
Director Seidel?
Aye.
Director Rice?
Aye.
Vice President Farmer?
Aye.
Director or President Pearson?
Aye. And I would like to thank the community and the people who spoke for their insightful and appropriate comments. Ms. Bettenhausen, thank you for yours, and everybody else that spoke. It was good input, and that's the reason that I asked this to be on the agenda, was to get some discussion on this.
If I could add one more thing, I believe the initial reaction to this item being on the agenda today was a certain, how could we say it, disappointment in how this board and the district continue to address issues that, how could we say it, confuse or even alarm members of the community. And if nothing else, I believe this particular item coming forward has not only increased community participation once again and how we do business here, but it's also caused two things. Caused us to react in hopefully a thoughtful and wise manner, and also, once again, put into the consciousness not just of us, but of the community with regard to the need for implementing the most efficient water conservation that all of us can do in this community. Thank you.
Okay. I am going to adjourn, and we will be back. We'll use the clock in the back there, and we'll be back at 25 after. Even though that's not the right time, we're going to use that clock just as a reference. We'll be back at Thank you, everyone, and we'll move along here. We are on item 4D. Mr. Weigel.
Yes, Mr. President, for 4D, staff is recommending that the Board of Directors adopt Resolution 40-2019, amending the CCSD salary schedule and establishing a pay schedule for the position of wastewater collection system worker. And I'll have Pam talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you, Board. So I just want to offer a little bit of background for you. So back in 2018, during the Bartle Wells rate study, there was a recommendation in the wastewater fund to add two additional staff, and those were the wastewater collection system workers that we're requesting approval for today. And we also included those as part of the Bartles and Wells study. We did include those two positions in the budget, so that is why you're not seeing a fiscal impact to augment the wastewater budget. These positions have been approved by the SCI Local 620 union. District staff met with them to agree to the salary schedule and the conditions of the position. So I can answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, anybody got any questions or comments? Yes, Director Rice.
I'm looking at page 35, the second paragraph from the bottom. The district has been successful during meet and confer. The union's representative has reviewed and approved the proposed position. It's proposed that the salary schedule be slightly less than the salary schedule for the position wastewater operator in training. I'm going to assume that was part of the negotiation that happened, but it seems to me collection systems, if you're not an operator in training. So I was just curious if there's an answer for why that might be.
These are generally entry level.
Okay.
And they're not on their way towards license.
I see.
Whereas EOIT is on his way to license.
Thank you. That's helpful. That was the distinction I needed. Thank you.
And if you look at the salary schedule that's attached to the back of the resolution, you will see how it falls in line with the salary schedule between the water treatment operator 1 and the wastewater system OIT.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Okay, my question is, have we got any of these guys identified yet, or girls?
We're working on it, but I think we have, Haley, we one or 2 weeks ad out so far. We've got zero, I think, as of 2 days ago.
Yeah, and the recruitment closes next Friday.
And we have no applications?
We have no applications at this time.
Ooh, that's not a good thing.
Well, I'd like to point out that even Step E is still considered low income for affordability levels if you want to apply for an affordable housing unit. So,
well, if we had more affordable housing in town, probably. No, let's not go there today. All right. Do I have a motion here? I'm sorry. Vice President Farmer.
Well, actually, I think my question has just been answered. I wanted to know, how difficult has it been in the past, to hire a competent collection system worker? And I guess that question has just been answered since we don't have any applicants this time. Has it been problematic in the past? Obviously, we need Mr. Green here John Alchin here to tell us that. But
I don't think the position existed, did it?
Correct. This is a brand new position, so we have not had a recruitment for this position in the past.
Well, I guess that was fairly obvious to everyone in this room but myself, so I'm sorry about that.
Well, may I? Following up on that, though, I think we do have two collection operators presently, do we not? We don't have any collection operators?
No.
Oh, forget. Okay.
All right. A motion to approve?
I move we approve that we adopt Resolution 40-2019, amending the district salary schedule and establishing a pay schedule for the position of wastewater collection system worker.
Very good. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Go ahead.
Director Steidel. All right. Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Director Rice?
Aye.
Director Steidel?
Aye.
Director Howe?
Aye.
Vice President Farmer?
Aye.
President Pearson?
Aye. Thank you. We'll now move on to
Mr. President?
Yes.
I'm sorry. It's all right. I just want some clarification. Why is it in the past that we haven't had a collection system worker, and why do we need one now? And I'm not saying we don't need one. I'm just asking.
I don't think there's anyone here that maybe knows the answer to that, because right. I think the previous general manager would have to answer that.
The only thing that I can offer to this is I remember when we were starting out in some of the reviews in IR&D of the wastewater requirements, and I remember conversations going on during that time period about the fact that John had been begging for these operators for multiple years, and it just had never been put on the table. And the Resource and Infrastructure Committee actually went out of its way to make sure that when we went through our budgeting process this year, that there were placeholders there for this to be able to happen, because it was such a need that Mr. Alchin had been verbalizing for such a period of time.
Yeah, I can add a little bit to that. You remember we're supposed to be looking at the distribution system every 5 years, and that we only did 20% of it? Well, Mr. Alton won't have enough people to do that unless he hires these people. These people will be used to do the manhole cover maintenance, and also to be cleaning and repairing and using the camera, okay, to do a visual on all of our distribution system throughout. And that's really Mr. Alchin's goal with hiring these people, is to get that finally done and underway. So.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So we have a motion, and it passed, and we can now finally move. Okay. Item number 4E, Mr. Weigel, do you want to just introduce this?
Yes, Mr. President. The staff's recommending, the Resources and Infrastructure Committee is recommending that the board discuss and consider for approval of their mission statement, goals, and objectives, which is listed in the your materials.
Okay, very good. I do have a request to speak on this from Ms. Heinrichs.
Yes, thank you. I would just like to thank the Resources and Infrastructure Committee for taking these steps to help Cambria improve its stewardship of resources in equipment as well as natural resources. Attention to Cambria's physical assets will help Cambria meet current and future needs, and I look forward to hearing more from this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, discussion. We have the mission statement, the objectives and goals in front of us. Anybody? Yes, Director Steidel.
These are just minor word items, but a suggestion for some clarification, perhaps. In the goals area, the first one is analyze and minimize loss of district water. I don't know that the committee is in a position of actually minimizing the loss, so perhaps saying analyze and assist in minimalization of district water loss is a possible restatement.
Can I? May I?
Yes.
It seems like a good idea. May I suggest?
Okay.
How about analyze loss of district water and suggest ways to minimize it?
Perfect. Better.
Gee, we're really good, aren't we?
The other one is actually the last bullet there under goals, where it says review and amend district conservation programs. I think probably may want to consider it in terms of review and recommend potential amendments to the district conservation programs.
Okay. Yep. Mr. Chairman?
Well, fortunately, we also have the vice chair in the room, and she might be able to add something as well. And I appreciate the comments made by the two directors here. But I just wanted to remark, I figured since I'm still having a lot of difficulty determining what the resource part is of resource and infrastructure, or resources, I should say, so I just took the time to actually look it up in the dictionary to find out what resource or resources mean. And I'm just going to read this. It's short. A stock or supply of money, materials, staff, and other assets that can be drawn on by a person or organization in order to function effectively. And I think about the valuable resources that we have in this community. And to me, the first one is water. The second one is the natural environment. And the third one is the intellect and imagination of the folks that live here and choose to and care about this community and choose to serve either on the board or as various committees. You know, those are major resources that we have. And I just wanted to put that in there in case, at least that would be part of my definition of the resources that are available.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, with a few minor amendments that we've made, Director Rice would like this.
I hesitate in making these comments because I really appreciate how much work that has been put in. But I do agree with the changes suggested by Director Steidel and Director Howell that minimize the decision making implications, or imply some kind of decision making rather than advisory role, or some kind of staff role rather than advisory to the board role, because they need to advise the board, not the staff. They work on behalf of the board. And so, like, things like discerning needs of the community is while it's important to understand what the needs of the community are, I think that that's beyond the scope of resources and infrastructure. And one of the reasons we added the resources onto the infrastructure in the title of that committee was primarily to include things like water supply management, which is one of our resources that we have to deal with. Because a lot of the other resources, whether they're human resources or actual like the trucks and things, the hard resources, are really stuff that the staff needs to manage, it seems to me. So to me, the resources that was added on for that committee was primarily related to the water resources, and we just didn't say water resources because it would have made the committee lengthy name. But that's my recollection of the discussion. And I also don't think that they could be supportive in the creating an inventory management system, but that is for sure a staff role. If the board wants the staff to do that, if the staff doesn't know how to implement that direction from the board, then we need to deal with that. But I think that if the general manager says to the board, "Okay, asset inventory management, that's great. What am I supposed to do with that?" Then maybe we say to the Resources and Infrastructure Committee, "Could you go and look at what might be available for doing that?" Because I do think we need an inventory management system, an asset management system for all of our things. And part of that is something that's up above about, or maybe it's below, about maintaining the lifetime expectations of different resources that we have, like trucks and all of that stuff. Touring and evaluating the facilities, I mean, just some of these things, they may be within the purview of what the board may want the committee to do, but it seems to me there's it needs to be more. And again, I don't say that, I say this from a place of just trying to make sure everybody understands what the role is. As somebody who spent the first 2 years on the board, learning what the role is of a board member. It's sometimes frustrating the limitations you have in a certain role, and freeing the kinds of authorities you can have in a certain role. I just want to make sure the board is clear with the committees that what we really need from them is driven by what we're working on at the moment, and that includes things we've already assigned to that committee, because they've done this great analysis of the water use over the years, and so I'm not saying they haven't done good work. I'm saying this seems to be a bit, some of these statements are a bit of an overreach. And I'm not comfortable approving them like this, because I think it doesn't speak to the authority of the board and the utility of having any standing committees at all. I don't know if that's helpful or just confusing.
No. And I think one of the authors of these would like to speak. Okay? Mr. Nugent.
Am I on? Got me good. Okay. I just wanted to say thank you guys for reviewing that. And just from my recollection, because I remember sitting down with Director Pearson specifically on the inventory management, and I think it was the inventory management is the specific one that I think I'm just trying to figure out. Is that really something you guys are worried about, this? You know, because I feel like I'm getting mixed messages, I guess, what I'm saying.
Yeah, understood. So. Yeah, and I think that the inventory management system is something that resources and infrastructure should be recommending, okay, how we go about doing that, okay? Do we hire somebody? How do we interface it with the financial system that we're going to be getting and putting online and getting all that done? And that was my discussion with
don't we have an asset management? I mean, it's a standalone system. I mean, it just hangs off of MOMS, right? But isn't there?
Not that I know of. Ms. Duffield?
Yes, we do. We have an Excel spreadsheet that lists all of our fixed assets. So that is any equipment that is over $5,000. And we routinely review that list at the end of every fiscal year to determine if there's any new assets purchased during the year. We put them on that list, and then we appropriately provide the accumulated depreciation also on our fixed asset list.
Okay.
We just don't have a current ability in our financial system today to do that in an automated fashion. So we had requested, and the board approved it back, I believe, in June, to add a module to our Tyler financial system to help us do that. Because, like, for instance, to track the cost to maintain a vehicle. You know, are we spending way too much on maintaining a particular vehicle, and we should be looking at replacement of that vehicle? We currently do not have the ability to do that through our financial system, so we will have that ability when we go forward with Tyler.
Okay. Good, number one. Number two, I don't know if the other rest of the board would, but I would love to see that list that you have of inventory, of the inventory list. Okay, if you could make that available to the board next meeting, maybe.
And I only have one other point that I wanted to add to it, is the touring of the facilities. Mm-hmm. I personally kind of came up with that idea, and I do think it's important. I'm not saying that we need to be constantly touring the staff's facilities, but I do think for the community to be able to take a look and see what we actually have going on, for example, where the wastewater facility is right now. I don't think people would have voted the way that they had in the past that's brought us into this position. So that's just my two cents.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Good deal. So anyway, that's my two cents. Thank you.
And the last two items of the objectives, it seems to me, should be, are more appropriately referred from the board if needed, because those are jobs the board really needs to do. If we're not doing them, it'd be nice to say, okay, we're about to get the annual report. Let's let resources and infrastructure look at it first. But these are things to reviewing the regulatory compliance is something this board should do. We shouldn't be farming that out. And I also don't think that we should be ensuring that the overall district priorities. I mean, I don't think the committee needs to be assessing their objectives every year. Otherwise, their objectives seem too narrow. These are general and not, in my mind, they should be general and not specific. The job is to take referrals from the board on issues of. And I think this is part of what the policy committee was struggling with, too, is like there's so much to do because we haven't had standing committees before, that what do you tackle first, and without closer referral from the board kind of one at a time, it may become an overreach that makes people do work they don't need to be doing because we won't be able to use it.
I have a little bit different view to that in terms of the objectives, because I do think that they're probably a mix. I think they're a mix of things that carry over from year to year that tend to be part of the meter of what the committee does as a whole. But I do think that there are items that are very specific that fall into an objective that needs to be viewed singularly, maybe for a number of months or for that year's period, to bring the focus to it to make sure that happened. And the reason I feel strongly about that is because when we were going through and doing the objectives for the Finance Committee, there were a number of those kinds of things because of what we were going through in reviewing the budget process and incrementally moving through that. So I do think it can be a mix of things that are being executed on a yearly basis and provide you with visibility and tracking, and then things that carry over from year to year.
Understood. I just think it needs to be clear that the agenda is set by things that the board needs advice on.
Oh, absolutely.
That's kind of where I'm coming from on those items, I guess.
And I guess maybe I can give an example that, at least in my mind, kind of delineates that progression. Very soon, we will have the audit completed for 17-18. And that is being done by staff. Now, part of the mechanism in it moving forward to the board is to have, for lack of a better term, a validation check or a sanity check that is performed by the Finance Committee in terms of the information that the finance manager would be bringing forward for the board's review. So there could be something within that review period that will bring up a question that we may feel is something that should be added to the summary information of the report, or that we can add that additional level of comfort for the board as a whole to know that there have been another set of eyes that took a look at something for the vote to be able to be done by the board. And I do think of that as being kind of the track of the committees as a whole in terms of how information is moved forward. I think that fits very well within the way that resource and infrastructure has worked and how that has moved forward with all of the items that were brought forward for need for the wastewater plant and everything else. I think and we can get into this as we go into our next item, but I think the only place where that ends up not being the case maybe is with policy, because that it has such a wide range of things associated with it that there may be something a little different in the way that things need to move through for that.
Okay, my other question is, do we have an asset management policy?
fixed asset policy, yes.
Yes, fixed asset policy. Okay, so my thing on that then would, for their goals, would be to review and make recommendations to the board on that policy and revisions to that policy that might be needed, and especially in keeping with the Tyler Inn code and what we're going to be able to do with that. I think it all meshes together. So I think that would be the place for you to start, okay?
I think maybe, yeah, the operative thing here is to review and make recommendations to the board. That is, I mean, we do like to have all these other minds looking at things, and I feel much more comfortable if something's brought from a committee. There's a chance that it's going to be more explained than if it's just a single thing. So I think, yeah, what is it? Review and make recommendations. I think if we, the other thing, if I may, assisting resources and gathering information, well, that's advice, that can be advice to the board. Otherwise, we're out there ourselves having to interview everybody. And, you know, so I don't see any problem with that one. Similarly, I think the next one down, discern the needs of the community, I would say, and advise the board regarding same or something. But again, to have people out there asking questions and bringing stuff to us, I think is probably where we want to go with that one. So having said that, I think so maybe make some modifications where I think where there's lack of clarity is where there's some sense that the committee is going to do something or create something which really they need to, it comes to us, you know, and that's, I think, yeah, as long as we're clear on that.
Yeah, I think we don't need to necessarily approve these now, but I think that since we're at the end of 2019 anyway, that that we are giving good direction now to the R&I committee on what they should be doing, and you know, part of the issue is that the board did not do a very good job of giving direction or guiding them and that kind of thing. Okay, and now I think we're doing a much better job of that, and the next item we'll do a better job with policy also, and then in December, January, they can revise these and have them ready for 2020 and be ready to move forward with that. I think that's a good place for us to go here.
I agree. I think the other concern comes from my experience as an educator. It's really easy to burn out really fast if you take on too much too soon, because you're excited about it. I mean, of course you want it. These people are very excited. They're volunteering their time. They're putting in a lot of effort to get this information put together. And I want to acknowledge and thank them for that. But I think it's important that we also say it's okay to not do everything this year. We do want to make sure we're going to get to everything, and we don't want to slowpoke it, but let's not burn people out either, because we don't want to have to be beating the bushes to get some people to join these committees when some of these folks decide they need to move on.
Yeah. Understood. Okay. So
Last and final comment. Well taken, well, I think.
Almost.
Oh, sorry, almost.
I just want to make a comment as the recently appointed chair of the R&I committee. I noticed that our vice chair, who was here at the beginning of this conversation, has exited the building, or at least this room, for whatever reason. So what will happen, you know, we'll just take this back to the committee. I think we have a pretty full plate for the November meeting next week. So we'll make this the main topic of discussion at the December meeting with regard to just reworking the mission statement, goals, and objectives, and bring them back to you for January.
Okay, Mr. Nugent's here too to carry forward that ball too. Yeah, he's hiding.
I can't see them back there. So
right.
I do want to thank Paul and Jim Webb for all the work that they did, and they're probably feeling a little bit frustrated right now. But life is often filled with frustrations, but we'll keep moving forward because it's Cambria. Thank you.
Director Howell's going to wrap this up.
Okay. Oh, it's just the last remark, because there was something said about what should be on the committee's agendas. And I do want to point out that if we say they can only deal with stuff that we give them, we're missing out on certain things, that some valuable stuff. Point, case in point is our two wastewater collection people. That was not on any R&I agenda. That came from John Alshin to the R&I committee and thence through that pathway. So we want to be kind of careful to not restrict these committees too much. They may want to bring something to our attention that maybe we've missed.
Yep, that's fine.
Well, I don't think there should be any restriction in the idea of suggestions that the committees may have coming forward to the board of whether or not that should be looked at, and then it's incumbent upon the board to decide if they want to have the committees take that action, and that's kind of the process we had started to get ourselves into. I don't know, this is an aside, but I wanted to make it. I think that the work and the content that the committees have brought forward is the work and the content that the committees have brought forward has been wonderful in terms of addressing items that have needed to be addressed for a long time. But the resources of just having a board to take a look at it and a staff that is working very hard doesn't facilitate that all the time. So in doing that, the other side of that coin, which I can see downline could be a frustration for the community observing it, is that because we've got folks to be able to identify these things and move them up and bring the information forward, doesn't mean that necessarily we'll be able to take immediate action on all the things that are brought forward to us. We can go ahead and get these things moving forward and get the forward momentum for them, and we can kind of eat the elephant a bite at a time as the staff has the opportunity to work through the process. But I just want to caution that frustration may come to the community, and I hope that they recognize that that's part of the process of growing this.
Okay. Thank you all. All good comments. First, I'd like to close that one out. Second, I would need a motion to continue to at least 5:30. That clock's way off, so.
You mean
4:30?
No, 5:30. It's actually quarter to five.
Oh, well.
No, we haven't been that quick.
So moved.
All right, so we have a motion to continue until 5:30. Do
second.
I have a second?
Second.
Second. Can I have a roll call vote, please?
Director Rice?
Aye.
Director Steidel?
Aye.
Director Howe?
Aye.
Vice President Farmer?
Aye, aye, aye.
President Pearson?
Aye.
You're only allowed to vote once.
All right, we're on to the last item on the agenda here for regular business, item number 4F. And Mr. Heinrichs would like to speak on this, if he'd be ready. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Hang on there, Gordon. Yes, sir.
Mr. President, staff's recommending that the Board of Directors review and discuss the attached CSDA list of example board handbook policies and provide direction to the policy committee regarding those that should be vetted for potential incorporation into the CCSD policy handbook. Additionally, staff's recommending the policy committee, in coordination with the finance committee, review and consider establishing a policy for the purchase of used or non-new equipment by the district.
Okay. Thank you. Now, Mr. Heinrichs. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I had thought that maybe Don would give his spiel first, but we'll see how this relates. What we as a policy committee has been having a tough time getting communications coming in forward from the board and the staff, et cetera. So what we're seeking here, is, in my mind anyway, is some direction, first of all, from the board, as is mentioned in the title, to prioritize those things that would be appropriate for the needs of the the board itself and the staff requirements. What is happening sometimes is we make recommendations based upon following the 1000 series and then making comments, and we present those. And if those aren't of importance, we would not like to present them and then have them tabled. Then we're stuck for another month or 2 months, and then what are we going to do to get back around to what we need direction on? So I'm suggesting that when we submit these policies with our recommendations, that we have time for the board or staff or whomever prior to the meeting to review some of those comments and see if they are within the ballpark of what we're aiming at, instead of saying, well, gee, we're just going to table it with no feedback. So that's our biggest complaint. And the other is that we were trying to get more direction concerning the board of directors and the staff relationships in regard to policies. And a lot of cases we'll deal with the staff and their knowledge of policies that they may have someplace but not written. And that's where it's stumbled along here a little bit, trying to get the right answer, because we're doing really well on comparing no policy with the written policy by California. So there's no thing, hey, here it is, this is all we have. But my understanding is we would prefer to have some permission, and how this is done, I'm not quite sure yet, is by the board of directors to have authorization to work with General Manager Weygard to get involved with his staff as appropriate, or he can assign staff members to attend a certain policy that might affect one of those involved. And how we go about that, we're not sure how that goes with the calling. So I don't know if your president here should be the one that directs the general manager, or he works back and forth if he's aware of what policies we're doing. So that's a big area of we're trying to move these forward, of answering your questions. And the other area of interest is the other two committees, as you mentioned, have needs to also participate with our agenda for policy to insert those where appropriate in the existing framework. And I don't know if we've established any great relationship there, only we hear something that they have a policy that might be considered, and no one's even came to us to get a numbering number to put, say, hey, we're going to call this such and such. And then obviously we're not interested in what it says. It's dealing with those individual committees. It's just trying to format a system here. And we don't know how that's coordinated to accomplish that task. And the other little point is if there's some concerns that we have as a committee as to whom has authority to authorize certain things, would be more appropriate to know ahead of time. The example might be the or the intent to serve letters for permitting that took place yesterday. We weren't aware of what was happening there in regards to what needed to be. So the Coastal Committee already had something permitted, and we weren't aware of it as a an organization, but from what we read from the agenda at that meeting, that the staff had taken on the responsibility to issue a letter of water intent to serve. And I think that sometimes that responsibility should be back to the board. And so if there are some levels there that we need to define as something that we'd like to address to make sure that things are going, and responsibilities that maybe should be a lawyer's input versus a staff person that's an engineer or accounting person or whatever, or should be the board that says, hey, yep, we want to take this on and not have a confusion that might be otherwise avoided. I don't know if Don has other comments, but do you have any questions so far of what I've noted? Or
No, thank you. So, as far as the agenda and getting the right staff people there, we do have a process now, I think, that you're aware of that we can use. All of the chairpersons and vice chairpersons should be aware that you know, that basically you guys get your agenda together and run it by the general manager, and he can then assign the appropriate people to come and stuff. So, okay. As far as that goes, I think we're in good shape. I feel that we've been most remiss with the policy committee and not giving them better direction and steerage and that kind of thing. But the work they've done to date has been very good. I think they got off track a little bit by going down the list, but, you know, they were doing what they felt was the right thing to do. So I don't have any problem with that. I'm glad that they've come back to us and asked us for more direction, because I think that's exactly what we needed to do. Instead of going through the list from CSDA, and there are several of those that are in this long list, probably half of them that we really don't need, okay? And so I would say that to direct the policy committee on what to do next would be to get a couple of policies that are existing and to be looking at those. Number one, Mr. Weigold has asked now for us to look at the purchasing policy, at least to revise it so he can make some purchases of used equipment, or in some cases scratch and dent, that kind of thing, if it's a hell of a deal. I'm not sure what the policy says now about that and about him having to bring certain things to us, but I think in the meantime, if the staff has a item or two that they would like to buy on that, if they would just bring it to the board for our quick consideration, I think that's the right thing to do until the policy committee has an opportunity to go through that. And they may have to pass whatever they decide over to finance to make sure the finance is good with it also. So, Mr. Weigold.
Yeah, so part of this revolves around time and speed. You know, John Alchin is our professional at this, scouring some of these auction sites for equipment. But there's a big difference between finding a used pump versus a used Vactor truck for several hundred thousand dollars. And so the time issue is what we're looking to speed up, because if it's something that's up for auction or on a used market, it's going to be gone by the time that the next board meets. We've discussed this with legal counsel in that if it's a single item that's not available anywhere else, we don't have to get two other bids like we normally would. But I really have no guidance right now on how to think about how to buy something used. I might think it's a great deal, and John Alchin might think it's a great deal, but somebody else might think it's a terrible idea. So we're talking about a pretty wide range. I mean, a used Vactor truck is to save $100,000, but comes with a warranty, is a lot different than a used pump, where we might save tens of thousands in some cases. But I just need a little further guidance, that's all. But the speed is, that's one of the key issues here, is the speed to get back, you know, to get through on the agenda. The items are generally going to be gone by then.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we're not going to be able to speed you up until they come back with something for us.
Right.
I correct me if I'm out of line in my understanding here, but I think if something is in the budget, it is to the general manager's discretion whether to purchase something used or not. If it's within the budget, and I mean, if it's an item that we've budgeted for,
yes,
it's, I think, entirely up to the good judgment of the general manager that we've hired.
And the staff.
And right. The staff. And if they think, because it comes with a good warrant, I don't think that requires board approval if it's already in the budget, does it? I mean, is there a limit, even if it is in the budget, that it has to have board approval?
It does not require board approval if it is in the adopted budget.
Okay.
But our concern is that our purchasing policy doesn't specifically give us any rules for purchasing used equipment.
Hmm.
So and we would have to sole source it every time, and is that appropriate? I see. So, and then again, the timing, like Mr. Weigold was mentioning, the timing. You know, so we wouldn't be able to get it through those channels.
So the purchasing policy has something about sourcing from more than one, and you're allowed to pay a little bit more if it's from a local business or something like that. But there isn't anything that says if you're buying it used.
Correct. So we would have to go the option of considering it a sole source, because when it's used, it may be a vendor that reaches out to us that says, I have this item. Are you interested in purchasing it? It might not be something that we can get used and get three other quotes for. So that's kind of our, we've been kicking this around a lot internally, and we're just unsure how the board feels about purchasing of used equipment.
Director Steidel.
It would seem that there's some reasonable criteria that could be established fairly fast, that it's almost kind of a march down. You know, first, is it in the budget? And that's, you know, a qualifier right there. If it isn't in the budget, is it on the CIP? What level is it rated on the CIP? And just break it in terms of ranges of, you know, under 50,000, 50,000 to 150, something like that. And I think that by potentially doing that and establishing some criteria, I could say, okay, it falls within these kinds of conditions that we've already established as items for consideration as sole source, and be able to bring it to the board quickly for decision. No.
No, I have to agree that we can't have them bring it to the board every time. I think that the policy committee and the finance committee, maybe ad hoc with the two of you, can get together on this. And the thing that I would want to look for is, okay, it's a used product, okay? How many miles, quote unquote, or run hours or whatever does it have? And does it come with a warranty equal to if we bought new? Okay, that would make sense to me. But those are the kinds of things that you guys have to discuss and come up with something, and then we put it in the policy and we get it done. I think that's the direction we want you to go in.
It seems fairly clear. What Mr. Weigel's comment actually is expressive of the need of a policy, because without policies, he has to come to the board every time, the same way with the rest of staff. So the more that we can do with well-written policies, the more efficient the staff will be, and they'll be happier as well, and we'll be happier.
Right. Let's give them good direction so that they can do their job.
So maybe we refer to the policy committee, the purchasing policy, specifically to add that, and then when they find other things, they can bring that and say, hey, there's this other thing. We might want to change this amount on this thing or whatever. But primarily so that we can get that one done first, but we should start with the current purchasing policy, so we...
Okay.
Yes.
So absolutely. Excuse me.
I'm inclined also to maybe consider taking a look at what policies we already have, because it's entirely possible that we have any number of policies which may have perceived shortfalls that could be addressed in the same way that the policy, the purchasing policy could be. So would it be possible for the board to, or the policy committee to either get a list of what policies exist? So I don't have
I think they did put something together like that. And if I may follow on that, because I think we need to ask certain questions. Does the policy exist? Policy on used equipment? No, doesn't exist. Is it adequate for current situation? Some of our policies are entirely outdated, and why would you want to buy a dot matrix printer, right? Or a DOS operating system?
System.
Is it legally current? Is it meet the current legal requirements of the state or the federal government? And is it reflective of community values? And that's the one I think that's most important, where some of the differences between the CSDA manual and mm-hmm. ours will be different. But I think if you can, I think to me, from what I've heard in discussion just at this meeting, Section 2200, if you start there and ask those questions, that's the inventory and property management. The purchasing policy is under the admin, so I guess Section 2000. Purchasing policy is 2135. But that and the inventory property management, starting with those, say, do we have it? Is it adequate? Is it legal? Then that gives, because starting at Section 1000, a lot of these things are already developed. I also think that we could easily take things off their plate, like the personnel, the compensation and benefits, because that's all stuff that has to be dealt with through the unions and our union labor negotiations. Those are policies that probably we won't be referring, don't you think? Personnel policies?
Yeah, personnel policies are the personnel policy we have now is way out of date and needs to be updated anyway. And some of it is union-based, but a lot of it is not union-based.
Okay.
So we do need to have somebody take a look at that.
Okay.
But I think they need to ignore the CSDA for now and just get a list of what our current policies are mm-hmm. and review all of those, and then they come to us and say, these are the five that we think we should be working on.
And or recommendations from staff. I mean, staff are the folks who have to be working with those policies and getting recommendations of where they have hurdles getting things done, as with the purchasing policy. We should provide an immediate reference point for considering a look-see.
May I? I think we're getting good direction. I don't know that we need specific board action at this time. I do have one question, though, regarding the purchasing of used equipment or purchasing in general. I know there are very important legal requirements, so some members of the committee or member is going to need to meet with district council or use some of district council's time. How, and this is kind of, a question has actually come forth to me about this, how do they need to, if I have a subcommittee, if we have a subcommittee working on this, would it be appropriate for me to delegate a person to talk to Mr. Carmel? Do I need to go through the board president or anything? No.
I think you could also use the CSDA model as a reference, since it is up to date to this year of whatever legal requirements. So the purchasing policy for CSDA, you definitely want to run it by Mr. Carmel, right. But since we have that to use, you can look at it and see, oh, this seems like kind of in line, or it seems like way out of whack to this, then you definitely would want to confer with that. At least that's my take on it.
Go through the policy and get all of your questions together mm-hmm. and then make one phone call to Mr. Carmel's office and get clarity and go forward.
I don't see
any problem with that.
We were getting some reticence as to, because we don't want to burn up the
district's
budget.
They need to be aware of how much Mr. Carmel and his staff cost.
I will remind them of that.
So that.
Remember, plumbers make more than I do.
It's true. It's true.
And we do already.
All right.
We've bought the resource. So.
So the chairperson, Mr. Howell, believes that he has enough direction out of it to proceed.
Yes. At our next week's meeting, we have some more policies coming forward, and I think I may have some more questions for the board at that time, more procedural issues that we may be, because there are some very, I've listened to the meeting about twice now, and I still am taking notes. There are some very specific concerns that the members have, so I want to be sure to bring those forward.
Yeah, you can do that next week.
Yeah, okay.
Because we'll have your report anyway, so.
That's what I figured, yeah.
Director Steidel, you have something to add?
I was just, the other thing, I think one of the issues for the policy committee has been the fact that what they support and how they have to do their work is so much different than the other two committees. And I think that as a board member, I mean, I certainly feel that we've kind of stumbled over trying to, you know, establish things for them, and it sounds like we did a lot of that this afternoon, and that's great. The other thing that potentially, and any feedback from you, Director Howell, would be appreciated, because policies go across so many subject matters, the idea that the policy committee composition would have the skill set in writing policy information for all of them is probably something you're going to grapple with too. So I don't know at some point whether having a conversation about how to address that, you know, whether it's an involvement of staff members who do have, you know, a daily knowledge of execution and so forth might be one way to do it. But I can see that potentially down line will be something that will be a hurdle that may have to be faced also.
Okay. We good? All right. Thank you. Next. Oh, yes. Sorry.
It's all right. Am I being recognized? Just a joke. I just wanted to mention one of the items that Mr. Heinrich brought up in his presentation earlier, and I just want to acknowledge that he is the vice chair of the policy committee. I think one of the first items he brought up was the issuance of intent to serve letters. And how is this being done by staff at the office and therefore being referred, I guess you could say, to the Planning Commission and then the Planning Department and then it going up to the Coastal Commission? Because it would appear, you know, we are under a building moratorium and yet somehow intent to serve letters are being issued by the district even though we're under a building moratorium because of being a lack of water. And there were two items that went before the Coastal Commission yesterday. One of them was taken back because of an accident from one of the applicants, but the other one was appealed by two members of the Coastal Commission. And so both they appealed it and staff recommended denial, and that's what happened. And, you know, we already have some difficulty with various local, state, and federal agencies with regard to taking up their time over things that aren't going to be approved for various reasons anyway. And it would appear that perhaps any item that has to do with, let's say, issuing an intent to serve letter, since we are the ones that determined, I remember the meeting back in August of 2013, where one of the members of this board who is no longer living in this community, much less on the board, said, we have plenty of water, we can issue 20 intent to serve letters, and then 3 weeks later the claim was, we don't have enough water to not only not issue intent to serve letters, but there has to be serious water restrictions. So it would appear to me that perhaps any decisions that are made on intent to serve letters should come before the board and not just being made by staff. And perhaps this should go to the policy committee so they can determine if that's the way things should be done.
I think it says in the ordinance it has to come to us. I don't know what the date of the intent to serve letter was, but we might have some clarification from Mr. President.
I don't think for those that were sent, I don't think it has to come to the board. I think they are acting completely within the current code and the current policies. And Mr. Carmel is shaking his head yes. So
I don't know the details. I know the details of a couple, but they're just following the municipal codes process.
Right.
I know in two cases that I was asked to look at last week, one came out of a settlement agreement from the late 70s, which is binding and certainly carries with it some potential liability if it's not followed. The other was not actually an intent to serve letter. It was a transfer
of an existing water meter,
which the district has nothing to do with. They just follow the code provisions. So I think you're probably right in some situations, but I know in the ones that I was asked to look at, there weren't intent to serve letters issued out of nowhere. They were issued because they were compelled to be issued under a settlement agreement, and one had nothing to do with the district at all. They just followed the provisions of transfer of meters under the code.
Well, I appreciate that clarification, but considering that it's kind of a touchy issue, and like I said, Coastal would probably like us maybe to have, you know, slightly more oversight, if that's possible. Before it goes to them?
Yeah. Okay, we're outside of the agenda. So we really need to, sorry. We can bring this up next week because we will be talking about the CDP and giving an update on the CDP, and this will probably be appropriate for that time. But for right now, it's we're outside of the agenda item. So future agenda items, if you would like to put something on the future agenda item for that.
Yeah, I would like to put on the future agenda item discussion of the issuance of intent to serve letters, okay, or even the transfer of water meters. Obviously, I don't know if we have any oversight over that, but it would be nice to have, you know, further discussion on that and maybe get some clarification from staff.
Good.
And the general manager.
Okay.
Second.
I'm still on the on 4F. I had one other item on 4F. I've been. Okay. And I'm not sure whether this was supposed to be part of the discussion or not, but there is an attachment to this that had the Policy Committee 2019 goals and objectives. And the second one there was to review district code and consider whether direction should be provided to draft amendments. And I'm a little confused in this, in that policy and code are two completely different things. You know, policy is, there are guiding principles. They're mutually agreed upon principles for an organization about how they're going to execute their work, whereas district code generally has some kind of governmental or legal interaction, and it defines mandatory actions that are carried through by the authority of a governing body. So I don't know that we should be looking to the policy committee to be reviewing district code, except in instances where perhaps there's some kind of clarification that the board would like to have them take a look at. But yeah. I think district code is not part of the process.
Good. What this comes from is this comes from a goal that we had that we assigned to the policy committee.
Right.
So that's where that almost verbatim is something
back
that
in January when they were first being formulated.
Right.
Yeah.
This board basically assigned it to the policy committee, so that's why they have it on there.
And isn't code essentially one of the methods for implementation of policies? So that's how it's connected. Yeah. I understand
but confusion, reviewing the district code for
consistency with policy.
For consistency with policy is one thing.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's what this says.
I think you're right.
Because I was just at a policy committee meeting where one of the individuals on the committee brought forth something wanting to bring forward an item for changing wording within the district code. And that's why I'm verbalizing this, because I don't know that that's what the intent was in the way that this sentence exists.
Yeah. At the same time, we don't want them not to bring things forward if they really think something needs to be changed. So that would be something that you would just take a note of and bring back to us.
Yeah. My approach to that one is, does the code reflect adequately and accurately reflect the policy, or does the code, for example, suggest a policy which maybe the board does not wish to have? So there are areas where, but yeah, no,
or even
exist. Not, yeah, not to rewrite the code.
Vice President Farmer?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Back on future agenda items.
Sorry.
That's okay. I have one, and I have a second on that, and I assume everybody's okay with that. Yeah, okay. So that's going to be on a future agenda item. Anybody else have anything for future agenda items? Yeah, those policies that you guys have already forwarded to us, you want those reviewed again?
I think the committee will need some feedback on those, at least to say this is really good, or gee, we have to think about this and put it aside, or send it back to the committee, say, no, please go back, and readdress this. But some reaction rather than just, I think the concern there is as we accumulate this list of policies that get passed to the board, and if there's no action, then the committee begins to start to feel very frustrated that they're spinning their wheels. So it's just mainly to get some board response.
Okay.
Yeah. Even if it's no response, yeah, I mean, that's a good response.
That'll be in December then. We won't be able to do it this next time.
Not next week?
Right. Not next week? Okay. Yeah, because it's too late for that. And we didn't have it on there. So, all right, I'll make sure that's on there for December. Anybody else?
Do we need to add an agenda item for the advisory to have that on the agenda, something about the... I don't know, consultant, you spoke about it, about the CDP and having somebody come on board to help out with the CDP.
Yeah, that's going to be part of the CDP discussion, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. We're good. All right, I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you. I will now open the closed session meeting. Is there any public comment? Excuse me. Any public comment on the closed session items? Hearing none, we will now go to closed session in the other.
Agenda item six.
Agenda item six. Thank you. And the first thing we're going to need to do is extend the time.